Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And what a card coming up this weekend. UFC 268. Can't wait for it. The UFC's return to New York. And as always, one half your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen, respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. Last weekend's UFC 267. What a weekend. I mean, Matt, you went 12-2. I went 11-3. And coming in from the week before, it's just been absolute madness, and it's been going great here with Fight Night Picks. Want to thank everybody who's tuned into Question Mark Kicks 2 hours live before the prelims. We offer up our final picks and predictions for the card, getting the opportunity to look at the weigh-ins and the entire week that always is. And then we also had the Fight Companion, which we'll have again coming up this weekend for this main card. And Matt, what a card we have coming up. I mean, 14 fights slated. We had one fallout today. Supposed to be Alexa Kammer taking on John Allen. Now Dustin Jacoby steps in on short notice. He's got some Factory X teammates on this card as well. But when I look through it, I mean, listen, 5 UFC debuts, plenty of ranked fighters, which you absolutely love to see. And out of those debuts, I mean, former champions from other organizations, CJ Vergara, just one of them, Fury FC flyweight champ, maybe Ireland's biggest future star since Conor McGregor in Ian Garry. Matt, I think this card's amazing, and I haven't even talked about the main card. What are your thoughts here?
We've been getting spoiled lately with some of these cards. There was a few lackluster cards sprinkled in there, but as of late, we got what? Marvin Vettori, Paulo Costa, an amazing fight. Then last week, we have the great pay-per-view top to bottom. And I know I don't want to pat us on the back too much, but we were saying just how good the depth was on that card, and it was amazing. From the first fight of the night all the way up until the main event, like, that was just a phenomenal card start to finish. Leading into this pay-per-view, isn't that wild to say too, from one pay-per-view to another? This is a phenomenal card top to bottom, and there's so many more fights to get excited for.
And for the Canadians out there, you know, last weekend definitely was a pay-per-view, but 14 fights total, so difficult for us to choose a possible fight of the night. You know it, love it, it's a fight of the night screen. As always, presented by Manscaped. Check out the sponsor, manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping on your order. Throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen. And when you're looking for a possible fight of the night on this card, it's hard not to look up at the top. Justin Gaethje taking on Michael Chandler. A couple of guys who have challenged for the belt in the past. For Chandler, you look all the way back to his fight against Charles Oliveira. And in the build-up to this fight, it's kind of like, yeah, I needed time to reboot. I needed time to find the love of the training again. For Justin Gaethje, I guess you could say the same, because his last fight was also for the belt. He looked to unify it against Khabib Nurmagomedov, and he was his stepping stone into retirement. Some ABC specials where they closed the door and Dana White said a couple of words to him. But ultimately, Matt, this fight should be absolutely insane between a couple of guys whose primary discipline's wrestling, but they're more known as gunslingers.
They really are. These are two guys who are from the Chuck Liddell school of fighting, where it's like, hey, we have wrestling, but let's just throw bombs to begin with. Now, I would say Michael Chandler's much more into the wrestling and grappling side of his game than Justin Gaethje is, but if you remember any of the build-up from the Khabib fight, Justin Gaethje himself is a natural wrestler. He did wrestle in college. I think this fight's going to be amazing. People forget, this was almost a Bellator lightweight title fight when Justin Gaethje was a free agent after the World Series of Fighting. Michael Chandler was really campaigning for Gaethje to actually go over to Bellator. Now, of course, Gaethje chose the UFC. We all remember his debut, but this fight could have almost happened many years ago.
Michael Johnson watching this one with a twinkle in his eye, as is Eddie Alvarez. It should be a great one. And when we look at the undercard, and it's closer to the end right now, tentatively slated as your curtain jerker ahead of the pay-per-view, we have Greece's Andreas Michailidis coming off a giant decision win over Canada's KB Buller, where he made him look like maybe not so much a UFC fighter. And for Michailidis, he brings in a particular set of skills. He is a European BJJ champion. He's got a little bit of wrestling and kickboxing in his back pocket, taking on Glory Kickboxing's own Alex Pereira, a guy who trains at Teixeira MMA. You know, your light heavyweight champion. Crazy to say that. But for Pereira, he's the only simultaneous two-division champion with Glory that they've ever had. Held the middleweight, interim light heavyweight, and then he unified it. He got that light heavyweight title, only to lose his last kickboxing fight not that long ago. But this should be absolute fireworks, and kind of crazy to look at that experience gap when it comes to pro MMA, but you fill that in with Pereira's overall kickboxing record, Matt, I absolutely love this fight.
I'm as excited for this debut as any in recent memory, because with Pereira, you know what his ceiling could be. You know he did knock out Adesanya. Now, yes, it was in just kickboxing, but still, that's an impressive feat nonetheless.
Beat him by decision before that.
Exactly. So if some of those kickboxing skills can translate into the cage, this is a guy who might find himself in a title shot in a very short amount of time. I understand this is a very high ceiling and a lot of praise to put on a guy who hasn't even made his UFC debut yet, but he has a massive opportunity this weekend. And for Mikhailidis, like, he can really kind of redo his career almost. I know a lot of people were down on him after his UFC debut. He looked amazing after KB Buller. So this is really one of those crossroad fights for him. If he can get the win over Pereira, then the sky could be the limit for himself. But he might just be the next stepping stone for Pereira to then become the next big star in the middleweight division.
Mikhailidis coming out of a big gym. MMA Masters with Miguel Baeza and a member of your main event, Colby Covington. So this should be a great one. Make sure you let us know down below in the comments section who you have and in a possible fight of the night, because this card is absolutely stacked. And when we threw it on over to those audience members in the YouTube community tab, looks like everybody's looking forward to that main event. Usman Covington, above 50% voted for that one. Should be a great one. Check out the sponsor, manscaped.com. Use promo code FMP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. And I urge you to please do. You're helping out the show. Big time slate of fights coming up. At the top of this card, it's absolutely stacked. You have rematches in both of the title fights. You have Gaethje taking on Chandler. Some people might absolutely love this one. I saw it on Reddit. It's just Trevor Whitman versus the other side. But just crazy to think that Team Elevation has been able to get to a place like this, to be able to dress to impress and really capture that New York City audience. I think it should be a great one. But Matt, I mean, looking up and down this card, it's hard not to get excited for Aya Quinta and Green. For Phil Haas and Chris Curtis, the fight that should have happened but didn't happen a few weeks ago. Edmund Shahbazyan coming back, taking on Nassourdine Imavov. I absolutely love it. I talked about it. 5 different debuts. I believe it's 8 different ranked fighters on this card, including 2 number one contenders in both of those rematches. This is a great one. And on Friday, if you're not already excited about it, there's also a rematch for a title over with Bellator 270. It's Queely Pitbull too, so a big-time week of MMA. I mean, I couldn't be more excited.
I'm so excited for this UFC card. You set it up in the perfect way. It has the perfect combination of new prospects who I do think will become household names in the near future, along with some of those big established names. And this is a huge fight for the title at the top. I feel like not enough people are talking about the fact that Colby Covington's really the only guy who's made Kamaru Usman look human in the UFC up until this point. And yes, Usman's made massive gains in his whole entire game, but like, this is a huge fight for the welterweight title.
It should be a great one. Make sure you keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks during the week with question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. I get asked a lot, what is QMK? Where did this QMK parlay come from? Question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. And the fight companion, everybody that joins in there, you get little inside nuggets of knowledge, the old inside baseball references. So make sure you check that one out. For the main card, Matt, I absolutely love this one. I know we're all psyched for it. Should be great. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
And a welcome to the UFC, to the former Fury FC flyweight champ. We have CJ Vergara making his promotional debut, taking on the Jamaican sensation, Ode Osborne. And for money's worth, this is one of those fights you have to get excited about coming up this weekend, because if you look at it for Ode Osborne, the guy is kill or be killed. He's a walking action man, and I absolutely love what he does and when he's doing it in the octagon. Unfortunately for Ode, you look at the UFC results, he gets submitted by Brian Kelleher, not so bad. Then he knocks out Jerome Rivera, up 2 weight classes, but one to where he normally was. That one was at featherweight. And his last time out, he takes on Manel Kopp in an absolutely amazing fight on paper. And at the start, Ode had a lot of success, but he was making that flyweight debut. He cut the weight. Manel Kopp didn't. He weighed in a little bit heavy. Either way, Manel Kopp wins that fight in impressive fashion. So for Ode Osborne, goes back to the drawing board. This is a guy that's a school teacher. This is a guy that trains at a Pura Vida, BJJ, and MMA with the likes of the Zach Ottos of the world. With Jamie Simmons that's in the UFC, there are plenty of fighters at Pura Vida, BJJ, including a former member of Fight Night Picks. You know her as Hot Take Kate. She spent a lot of time at Pura Vida, BJJ. But for Osborne, when he's fighting and when he's at his best, you talk about silhouettes and fighters, very, very unique, very long, very good with his long-range weapons. And if it goes to the ground, he's a guy that you really have to be worried about if you're his opponent. Comes into this fight taking on CJ Vergara, and you talk about a guy who has a lot of fun fight tape to go back and watch. You look at how he booked his ticket into the UFC. It was a win on this past season of Dana White's Contender Series against the guy that used to be in the UFC, that was on The Ultimate Fighter, Bruno Correa. And if you look at that fight, man, wow. I mean, CJ was a big enough underdog in that one. Everybody was going with Correa. And in that one, knee to the body, sends his opponent away, hammers away some more, lands another knee to the body, and that was all she wrote. For CJ Vergara, it is absolutely kill or be killed in his fights, not just that fight on Contender Series. Again, I had absolutely a ton of pleasure going back and watching his fights. This should be a great fight.
I don't know how this fight's going to be boring, and I'm so glad you set it up this way, because both guys do have that kill or be killed style. Like, Jimmy Manoa was probably really happy this fight got put together. With Ode Osborne, I can openly admit that every time I think he's going to win, he seems to lose, and every time I think he's going to lose, he seems to win, and I don't feel like I have that bad of a read on his skills. Like you said, he's a good long-range striker. He can switch stances a little bit, although he does lack some defensive abilities when he does decide to move his feet that way. But my issue with Ode Osborne is it just seems defensively he's lacking in a lot of areas. And it's not just the defensive side of striking. Even his defensive grappling isn't great. And that's the weird thing about Ode Osborne. He is a dangerous fighter on the mat, but he's one of those guys who can be held down. He can sort of be out-physiqued at this weight class. And I guess that's really the question that I do want to give to you. Do you think he's cutting too much weight to get down to 125 pounds? Because when he's fighting, he is such a big guy for this weight class. His frame is massive. Do you think he could be one of these guys who just suffers a negative effect because he does get down to 125?
Well, when, other than his last fight, has he fought at 125? That's the thing. I just think, I don't know who kind of led him to the decision. He's always talked about, you know, I am a 125er, eventually I'll move down there, and then finally he does. He gets his chin checked by one of the better strikers that was outside of the UFC, and now I feel like Manel Kopp kind of came onto the scene with that win over Osborne. People are going to forget about the weight miss, but the trouble I have in a fight like this, neither one of these guys is all that, I don't know, leveled up in terms of their striking defense or wrestling defense. So I think skill for skill, they match up incredibly well together.
No, I agree 100%. Ode Osborne's going to have a really hard time keeping his range in this fight. And that really should be his key throughout this matchup. Because if he is able to keep Vergara on the outstretch of his shots, we saw in the Rivera fight. Now, yes, Rivera didn't have the best run in the UFC. I can already hear the people in the comment section. But still, if you just take the positives from that matchup, like, Ode Osborne could be a serious threat. If you do match up his submission ability, especially his defensive submission abilities, you think, okay, if he could get slightly better wrestling defense, then maybe he could be one of these guys who can light fighters up at the outstretch of his reach, and when they do decide to close that distance, he could rely on some of his submission abilities. My issue with Osborne, though, is exactly what you said. It's his lack of defensive wrestling, which then sort of opens up his lack of defensive striking. I think if Vergara can get on the inside of Osborne's striking range, he's going to have a really easy time going to the body, going to the head of Osborne, because this is one of those Teddy Atlas points. If you're fighting a skyscraper, you're going to have to take some windows down. And that really is the key when you're taking on a guy like Osborne. If you do go to the legs and go to the body, limit some of that dynamic movement of his, I think it's a much more winnable fight for CJ.
Well, for CJ Vergara, going back, doing the tape study on him, because you can't just watch that Dana White's Contender Series fight, although it was a great one against a UFC caliber
fighter. Those body
fighter,
knees are gross.
Former UFC fighter. But if you look at it for Vergara, his head coach is Pete Spratt at a Pete Spratt's Muay Thai. And if you know that name, and I'll say it again, Pete Spratt, see, I can't do it even more than twice, too quick. He beat Robbie Lawler in the UFC, and then his next fight was in TKO, and he lost to George St. Pierre. So yeah, that Pete Spratt. But when you look at it, for Vergara, very, very good striking, very good movement on the feet. I like the way that he moves his head, and he doesn't plot forward, but he does kind of move at odd angles. So to try and hit him is difficult, but he leaves his hands wide open and he gets hit a lot. And the fight that I went back to all the time was a fight when he took on Silva. And I wrote it down, Matt, because in that fight, and listen, that wasn't that long ago. Again, Jacob Silva, Fury FC, that was for the belt. And man, he had a rough go. I mean, for Silva even, he fought on Contender Series a couple of times. He lost a split decision to Jeff Molina. Okay, and then he got finished by GP Bays. Okay, I guess. So then he goes back to the regional scene. He dropped CJ Vergara in that fight. Not a one time, But twice in the first round, almost has him finished. And then in the second, he starts to kind of fall off a little bit. That's when CJ starts to have some success. And of course, CJ wins that fight. But I just go back through it. He's super, super aggressive. And he's so focused on getting that finish that defensively, it just leaves a lot to be desired, especially against the high-level guys in this weight class. So the way that I look at this fight is that if Osborne can catch him coming on the way in, I think he can win this fight by finish. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if Osborne did win this by crazy highlight reel. Think like Dwight Grant, Carlo Pedersoli, where he like ducked under the high kick, hit him with an overhand. Something ridiculous like that. My issue is that other than that one big action on the way in for Vergara, I actually think CJ can win rounds in this fight if he can get on the inside of Osborne's range. Because if Osborne was a slightly better wrestler himself, if he did have some ways to just stop the forward momentum of Vergara, I would like him in this matchup a little bit more. But I'm finding myself siding with the underdog and with the guy making his UFC debut because I just haven't loved what I've seen from Osborne throughout his UFC career. I really like him when he can establish that range, but we've seen too many guys get on the inside of it.
For Vergara, I mean, coming into this one, 5 wins in a row, all 5 of them by finish, 6 of his 9 wins total by finish, and he's had a lot of different little layoffs due to injuries. He talked about that before his Contender Series fight. He had a big ACL tear a number of years ago, so just something to look out for as his career progresses. You might actually find it surprising if you weren't looking at the graphics. Maybe you're just listening on iTunes and Spotify. Yes, we have a podcast. The fact that Vergara is actually the older fighter coming into this one. Matt, you tipped everybody off. The odds for this one, Vergara opened the underdog plus 130s, plus 142 right now. Osborne open a minus 150s, minus 172. We have not looked at the Tapology votes. They're going to be a surprise to us. They are to you. I'm going to say 65% over under going with Osborne.
I was thinking 60% Osborne, so I'll say under.
Yeah, look at that. 989 total votes, 63% Vergara, 72% by knockout for the 37% that have Osborne, 37% by decision, 37% by knockout, 17% by submission. 3 sevens in a row, that doesn't make for 100%, but they never really do over on Tapology. For me, when I look at this fight, again, everything that I have in my notes, I really do like Vergara. Good check left hook, good footwork, good head movement. His hands drop after a combination, which is how Ode Osborne capitalizes in a lot of different exchanges. He's been dropped in a number of different fights. I think Silva, Jacob Silva's a good fighter. Don't get me wrong. Losing to Jeff Molina by split decision and losing to JP Bays in Contender Series, water off a duck's back. That's cool. You deserve to be in there. Beating Bruno Correa, too. That's a good win. The guy's record was, what, 12-3-1 going into that fight? And I wrote down the odds for that one. Correa was a minus 200 favorite. So, again, Vergara's come through as an underdog in his last fight. I just really don't like how much he gets hit. I don't like how much he drops his hands. I like Ode Osborne here. And the other thing that I like out of Osborne is his kicking game. Could it get caught, or could it get him caught, especially with a counter from Vergara? There's a possibility, but once he establishes distance, I'm assuming that's going to happen. I like Osborne for those reasons. I think Vergara is going to be a fun 50-50 fighter in the UFC. But that's about all I have for you.
Yeah, I don't think Vergara is going to get into like the top 12 range. I guess you could say top 15 at this because like one or two wins in flyweight can basically get you just cracking that top 15. But I do think Vergara can get this win over Osborne. Like you said, range is going to be the really big factor for both guys. If Osborne can keep Vergara on the outside of his range, just sort of taking pot shots at him, setting up his kicking game like you had mentioned, he should have a lot of success. But if Vergara can get on the inside of that, because the great thing about forward pressure is it is really hard to throw kicks if you are moving backwards. So if Vergara can establish his range, get on the inside, start going to the body a lot, it should be able to set up a game plan for him to win. But this really is a 50-50 fight. I could see a world where either guy wins via TKO very easily.
Winner fights Bruno Silva, loser fights Alan Nascimento. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy, Matt. We're split on the pick. I'm going with Ode Osborne. You're going with CJ Vergara. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight. Make sure you tune into Question Mark Kicks 2 hours before the prelims this weekend. Final picks and predictions and the fight companions. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And a welcome to the UFC, to the former LFA featherweight champion. We have Bruno the Tiger Souza looking to take on Melsik the Gun.
Bogdazarian Amat. As far as nicknames are concerned, one is incredibly aggressive and one is aggressive if provoked. Depends which way you want to take that one. I don't know. But when I look at this fight, we have Amelzik Bogdazarian coming off of an incredibly impressive UFC debut. Giant knockout win over Colin Anglin. Really proved the doubters. Proved myself, proved yourself wrong with that fight. Because for Amelzik, the one knock against him, and I'll talk about all of the pros to the one con. Yes, he lost his debut fight by submission. A lot of people do that. Alex Pereira lost his first fight. Some things happen, and then you end up in the UFC, and you have less than 10 pro fights. It just happens. But for Melzik, when he took on Colin Anglin, the big talking point was, okay, he's going to be able to strike with him. Can he defend the takedowns? And he didn't really have to worry about it all that much in that fight, because Anglin decided, well, I'm a striker now. So in that fight, Melzik, highlight reel knockout, go find it wherever highlights are found. Now you have Bruno Souza coming into the UFC. Matt, this is a kid that's been practicing karate since the age of 4. He decided he was going to train at the Machida Academy at the age of 12.
You love it.
Now he's coming into here in his mid-20s, middle of 25, having a great day, having a great time, having fought some very good competition over with LFA. Now, did you think that he won all of his fights? I don't know. Some of them are close. The fight against Mike Hamill where there's an illegal strike, Mike Hamill's probably winning that fight. Hey, he had a competitive fight against Adam Boric, so just simmer down a little bit. But when I look at Bruno Souza, and you want to talk about pure karate strikers, and I'm not going to throw out anything out there that's going to get me in any trouble, but this guy makes karate noises when he strikes that people like Wonderboy Thompson do not. But accolades and everything aside, I think this fight, style for style, I highly, highly doubt that we see this one go to the mat.
I was going to say, I don't know what the over-under is for takedowns attempted, but it's probably like 0.5, I'd guess. Probably just zero, yeah. It is probably like a minus 1,000 for no takedown attempts. This should be a phenomenal fight. I remember how critical we both were on Melzik coming into his UFC debut. It was, yes, we love the flashy strikes, and that's what it was too. It wasn't just the fact that he could go in there and get knockouts. It was just the impressiveness in which those knockouts were coming by. Like, he was getting poster dunks every single time he was going out there. But how many times have we seen dangerous, flashy strikers come into the UFC, get fed to a wrestler immediately, and then that wrestler goes like 13 for 17 on takedown attempts? And they kind of destroy the hype. That's what my prediction was going off of in that fight. And I thought Bogdazarian was going to have a very tough night out. Oh my goodness, he proved me wrong. And the great thing about Bogdazarian that I did not think he was going to have at this level was he's got the good takedown defense footwork. It's not the fact that, oh, he can dig under hooks like Alexander Volkov. It's the fact that he doesn't let his opponent get close enough to take him down in the first place. And that's the thing that I always love when you're looking at a guy who might have, let's say, suspect takedown defense. Well, you never really have to worry about how bad his takedown defense is if his opponent can't get close enough to put his hands around him. Now, that's not going to be a factor in this fight, but what I will say is that does speak to the range finding of Melzik and just his range capabilities throughout an MMA fight. I do think his ability to judge range with a wrestler is going to pay off against Bruno Souza, because what Bruno likes to do in a lot of his fights, like you had mentioned, he's a karate stylist. He likes to bounce on the outside quite a bit, and if Bogdazarian can get that range very early and force Souza to just be jumping into range constantly, I think Melzik can pick him off quite easily throughout this fight. But the flip side is Souza might be able to evade a lot of those big power shots and then be able to throw his own combinations together.
It's really going to come down to who gets frustrated first. Exactly. And what do they do when it happens? Because for Bogdazarian, and I will go through it, former international kickboxing champ with WLF, you know, WLF Wars, who one prospect's great and one prospect has a couple of fights in the UFC or wherever they end up and they're gone. But he had a 3-0 pro boxing record, a 9-2 pro kickboxing record, his MMA record, it speaks for itself. I put it up there in the graphic, the fact that it's Armenia and the USA, but I really wanted to kind of give credit to both countries because originally he's from Armenia. He trains out of Glendale Fighting Systems or Fighting Club. And yes, he's been training with the Ronda Rouseys of the world for a very long time, since a very young age. Edmund Shabazian also on this card, so there's a little bit of familiarity there. And that's the thing, on this card, there are only a few different outliers, and obviously Bruno Souza being one of them, that, hey, that's the one guy or the one gal that trains from that one singular gym. But to have the Weber Almeidas to train with every single day, Bellator prospect, to have Lyoto and his brother Chinzo Machida to train with and to learn from, absolute studs. And again, you look at the way that Bruno Souza fights, it's very long, it's very rangy. a lot of single shots and then a little bit of a reset. But what he will do is as he resets, if you lunge forward, he throws great counters and you have to be very, very cognizant of that. But I'm not telling world-class strikers anything they don't know. They're probably not watching this video. But again, when I went through everything, I was just so kind of struck by how good these guys are at pure striking. And for Bruno Souza, let's give him the credit he deserves. He is a national, South American, and world karate champion. The last time he earned one of those world nods was back in 2015 when he was a much younger man. But again, you look at this overall, all around, you know, iffy takedown defense, very good striking, kickboxing versus karate. I think we have on paper a very fun matchup. I still don't know where either of these guys are going to go ceiling-wise because Melzik, has he won any giant titles in any big promotions? No, but for Bruno Souza, the other featherweight champs that LFA's had, and I'll list a few of them, Kevin Aguilar, he was around in the UFC for a bit, Thon Lee, Damon Jackson, Justin Gonzalez, and Bruno Souza. So listen, a lot of fun that you can have with a matchup like this. To me, if I'm breaking it down before I even talk about the odds, I think Melzik's the more aggressive fighter, and I don't necessarily know if that's going to get him in trouble here because Bruno Souza has power, for sure, 100%. I don't know if he has the fight-ending power to make Melzik pay when he comes in on those entries.
And I don't think he sets up his power shots effectively enough because with Bogdazarian, he will set up his big shots with some of those pitter-patter strikes, and he will throw in combination. And when Bogdazarian's at his best, it's 1-2, then he throws the kick, and he does really like to set up his kicks. With Souza, he does sort of rely on the counter-striking capabilities of his hands a little bit too much for my liking. I agree 100% with your aggressiveness point, too, about Bogdazarian. This fight should be a lot of him moving forward and Souza reacting to it. Now, if Souza is able to land a big counter shot, maybe he can put Melzik down, but I feel a lot more confident siding with the guy who is moving forward, throwing in combination with a really high volume throughout this fight, because if Bogdazarian can just throw enough strikes together, that's normally when he can find his own power shot.
The odds on this one, Bogdazarian open -185, he's a -300 favorite right now, little rich. Bruno Souza opened a +160, he's a +236 over on Best Fight Odds. Currently, the Tapology votes are a surprise to us. They are to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Bogdazarian.
I was thinking 70, so yeah, under.
Wow. Yeah, over. 778 total votes, 81% Bogdazarian, 23% by decision, 70% by knockout. For the 19% that have Souza, 49% by decision, 29% by submission. For me, yeah, I like Bogdazarian in this fight. The thing that scared me the most as to his UFC debut was the fact that after the episode of Dana White's Contender Series that he won, and we'll talk about his opponent a little bit, it was Dennis Bazukia, and he won that one by decision. Dana White didn't want to offer him a contract. He wanted to offer him another spot on Contender Series later on in the year, and he just kind of waited it out. And then he got a contract at the end of the spring, early summer, ended up in the UFC against Colin Anglin, a guy who had already been booked in his own big fight against Sungwoo Choi, but that fight fell out. So it was just a weird way of that one coming together. For Souza, it's that traditional path that we never see anymore of American regional champion, having enough fights, you're in the UFC. And for Souza, we didn't really talk about it either, the wins and the quality of wins. I thought Elijah Johns beat him in the split decision loss, or sorry, win that he has from 7 months ago. And then when he fought Javier Garcia, that was a good win. Even before the Johns fight, Guilherme Santos by knockout. And then before that, he beat Kamala Kirk by split decision in a weird fight because it kind of fought in mirrors in that one.
The good thing, though, is I would rather a guy win a close fight to Kamala Kirk than just blow the doors off people who we've never heard of. Like, Kirk, I would say, is a pretty good level of competition for the regional scene. I think there's a path to victory for Souza. I think we should just lay that out quick. If he can make Bogdazarian miss enough early and really frustrate him, then he should be able to land a big shot of his own because he does move so well on the feet. And that's going to be the big key for Bogdazarian. If he throws leg kicks early, he should be able to slow down a lot of that movement from Souza, and that should open up his own combinations. But let's say Souza does just stay on his back foot, stay on his bike really early in this fight, kind of fight that Caitlin Chookagian game plan. I never thought I'd say that in a million years. Then he could have success later on in this matchup. I just really like the volume and the output from Bogdazarian.
Both of us going with the American citizen, Melzik Bogdazarian, to get the win. Let us know down below who you have in this battle of extremely pure strikers. It should be a great one. Big time fights up at the top. Gaethje Chandler, 2 rematches for the belts. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Hold the phone. Stop the presses. Alexa Kammer's not fighting this weekend. We now have the Hanyak, Dustin Jacoby taking on Brazil's John Allen. And I'm going to let the cat out of the bag incredibly early. I actually had John Allen to beat Alexa Kammerer. I have no idea what the odds were, but I was going with the Muay Thai man out of Shoot the Box Monstro to get the win. And for John Allen, it's been the weirdest run in the UFC because if you look back, the 5-on-in, it's not all that sexy. A win over Edvaldo de Oliveira, a loss to Vinicius Mohay on Contender Series.
You hate that.
That guy. Then he ends up, he fights Alessandro Silva on the regional scene and he gets a win there. And then 2 years and 3 months ago, which was a month removed from that win, he fights Slow Mike Rodriguez, and he beats Slow Mike Rodriguez, and then he tests positive four, and I want to make sure I get this one right, because it's really tricky when you start talking about this stuff, tamoxifen. But if you listen to it from John Allen, and you can kind of see it in that picture, he had gyno when he became a teenager, and it plagued him as he was an adult, and really when he'd go to cut weight, it would cause him issues, it'd be painful, whatever, so maybe there was a little bit of tamoxifen, but it was before he came into the UFC, but he still tested positive for it, he still had the surgery even before that, and regardless to me, honest to goodness, I take the man at his word, I don't think he was trying to cheat the system or anything, he beat Slow Mike Rodriguez, it's a no contest on his record. We cleared that one up, he served his time too. And then he comes back and he fights Roman Delige in a fight where nobody really knew who won that one. I thought Delige won. He took him down, but he didn't do a lot with it. He has more overall total strikes if you look at the numbers, but a lot of them are on the ground. And when it was standing, John Allen was teeing off. He was having a lot of good success. So he was supposed to take on Alexa Kammerer. Now Factory X MMA's own Dustin Jacoby is inserted into the picture. He's got teammates on this card. One of them's Jordan Williams. He's got his work cut out for him against Ian Garry.
He certainly does.
But when I look at this fight, Matt, Dustin Jacoby, since he stopped being a kickboxer with Glory, which that's going to be a theme for this episode too, because Melzik Bogdasaryan's a kickboxer. Dustin Jacoby's a kickboxer. Oh yeah, Alex Pereira's a kickboxer too. He's pretty darn good at it. So for Jacoby, you look at the recent run and man, wins against Ty Flores on Contender Series, beats Justin Ledet by knockout, beats Max Grecian, barely, but he beats him. Beats Iwan Kutsalaba once the takedowns were gone. That was a really close one, but he didn't. And then the fight against Darren Stewart his last time out, which was only a couple of months ago. What can I say? Like, Dustin Jacoby looks like a whole new man since he debuted in the UFC years and years ago.
You might think I'm crazy for this, but I think Dustin Jacoby is like the 16th ranked light heavyweight in the world. I really do. I think if you beat him, then you can officially be in the rankings. And if you lose to him, you don't deserve to be in them. And I think it's very, very simple that way. Because with Jacoby, are there ways to beat him at this weight class? Of course there are. If you're a dominant wrestler, you're going to be able to get him to the ground. If you're really strong in the clinch, I guess that would speak more to wrestling again, then you can kind of hold him up against the cage. You can out-volume him on the feet too. Like, he's not the perfect fighter by any means. But he brings a very refined skill set to the cage, and there's something to be said for a guy who just knows what he does well. And what Jacoby does well is he is a very good Muay Thai fighter. And he's been sort of a frustrating guy to watch, I'd say. Not as frustrating as Roman Delize. You brought up that name earlier. I just feel like I have to say that. Nobody's more frustrating to watch compete in the sport of MMA.
Hey, Coach Nixick, what should I do?
Like,
don't grab his leg. Just finish him.
Yeah.
End the fight.
That's enough on Delize, I guess. It's just, he always frustrates me when I see him fight. But my whole argument for John Allen is that he lost a close fight to Delize where I thought he looked much better than he was going to. But other than that, I don't think you know Muay Thai Dustin Jacoby in this matchup. I know it's on short notice, but I still think Jacoby's the much faster guy in this fight. I think he's the more defensively sound guy in the fight. Because you have to remember, he ate bombs from Iwan Kutsalaba and was able to stay upright afterwards. That's not something many guys in this weight class can say. Like, Glover Teixeira did that, and now he has the title. I can't believe I just compared Glover Teixeira to Dustin Jacoby, but let's just get past that. When you look at Dustin Jacoby, does he do anything that jumps off the page and really wows you? No, but I think he's a sound enough fighter to get by the majority of unranked light heavyweight.
To have the confidence in yourself to take this fight, he must be a little bit like Sean Strickland like 3 years ago.
That's a good point.
My addiction's training. I love it. Like, the only thing, literally the only thing on this planet I love to do, girls, sex, whatever, I will pick training any day over any other thing on this planet.
All right, so yeah, I used a Fight Night Picks clip from 3 years ago from UFC Moncton. What of it? Dustin Jacoby's nothing like Sean Strickland in like his MMA fighting interviews or anything he says on the internet. Just that one bit. Because he must train so much and he must be absolutely fit and ready for a fight like this. We do not have odds on this fight because it was just announced like 8 hours ago or thereabouts. But when you look at this one, Tapology votes are going to be a surprise to us. They are to you. We're all in this one together.
We are.
I have no idea what they're going to be. Son of a gun. 264 total votes, so it's early. 94% Jacoby, 25% by decision, 67% by knockout. For the 6% that have Allen, 53% by decision, 33% by knockout. I see this one going the decision. I think John Allen has a great opportunity. Hell, I talk about props. I have a Stipe Miocic bobblehead when he went to, what is this, the captain's game? And I went so indeed. Look, he's got a little fire hose there. Why? Because Alexa Cameron is supposed to fight John Allen, and it would have been a pretty cool thing to do the strong style comparison. So now I just get to show you this neat piece that's going to go in the background. There. He goes right there. But when I focus on this fight, Matt, both guys very credentialed with their stand-up. Again, the shoot the box with John Allen. He's got great people to train with there, like Laureano Staropoli. And great fighters like, I don't know, Jennifer Maya, Charles Oliveira.
Charles Oliveira, I was gonna
say. There's a lot of fun fighters there. But when it boils down to this one, I think it's just going to depend on activity. John Allen, do not look at his stat line because it's stupid silly with the amount of ground strikes he's taken throughout his career. So the numbers are bad. Dustin Jacoby can really get it done. The trouble is, who starts quick and early and who's able to build up that lead into the second round if there's not a finish? Because for Jacoby, in the Grecian fight, a little bit of a slow start. In the Kutsalaba fight, takedown, 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 takedown. And then he comes back. I think to me, it depends on who's the fastest starter. And that's a really hard thing to try and predict here.
It just really sucks for John Allen that he was going to go into this matchup as being the much more technical guy than Cameron. Because Cameron can miss big when he throws his big power shots in the feet. So there would be massive opportunities for John Allen to counter him on the inside and use his superior Muay Thai technique to get away with the win in that. The issue is that he's not really going to be able to just rely on his technique in this matchup. If he just tries to stand at range and blast leg kicks with a guy like Dustin Jacoby, that's when Jacoby will be able to check kicks, get his own range, and just counter with his own strikes at the middle. This is an unfortunate opponent change for John Allen because he went from being the much more technical guy in what was supposed to be his matchup to now kind of finding himself a little bit behind his own Muay Thai. So I do like Jacoby on short notice. I know I don't normally pick fighters on a week's notice. Just Jacoby and Allen. This is a tough fight for Allen, that's all.
Yeah, both of us going with Dustin Jacoby here. I think you look at a guy that can L-step, they're long movements.
And he can shoot the takedown, too, if he really needs to. He's not a great wrestler or grappler by any means, but he's shown that ability in the past.
Wouldn't be surprised if we see that in this fight. So both of us going with a short-notice replacement, Dustin Jacoby. But listen, John Allen could pull off a big-time win here against his second opponent in the week. So let us know who you have down below in the comments section. Really looking forward to this weekend. If there's any other changes, anything else happens throughout the week, we'll try our best to get those individual fight videos out there. But if not, question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims and then the fight companion for the main card. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
So coming up this weekend, we have a battle at heavyweight. And this is one of those ones that convinces one or two guys out there that are watching this fight. They're sitting in their office. They got a handful of Halloween candy and they're going to go, you know what? I'm going to risk it all. These two guys can do it in the UFC. Screw it. So can I. We have Jean Vellante taking on Beast Boy Chris Barnett. And Matt, I have nice things to say about this fight, and I have a lot of not so nice things, but when I do look at this one for Chris Barnett, he was a guy that in 2014, Bleacher Report said he's the next big thing at heavyweight. And then he made his UFC debut in 2021 and got submitted by Go-Go Choke, which is a modified guillotine, against Ben Rothwell. Is that his submission of choice? Yes, it is. He's crazy when it gets to that. It's pretty good. And in that fight, Chris Barnett got taken down in the first round. What happened?
He got back up.
He got back up to his feet. He has that ability, like Derek Lewis, being a giant heavyweight. Less than 6 feet tall, though, but giant heavyweight. Used to fight at super heavyweight, where he just wills himself back up. And it was positionally sound enough that he didn't get submitted in it. And it was at the end of the round, which shows a lot of heart, especially when, at the start of the second round, he looked like he had ran 5 marathons. So it wasn't that great in the second round for Chris Barnett. But the buck doesn't stop being passed right there, because for Jean Vellante, I have a couple of people that just continue to get UFC bookings that I sit there and I go, they cut Elias Theodorou for this kind of stuff. And yes, Elias is a bad example, but he won a lot of fights and only lost a few and lost to Derek Brunson. See you later, walking papers. Okay, Randy Marcos was 1-5 and had lost 4 in a row, dating back a number of years before she fought Lavina Souza not that long ago. She won that fight.
That's pretty good. She did look good, but still, what are we doing here? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Sam Alvey.
How dare you?
Since he beat John Volante by split decision in 2018, is 0-6-1 and has a fight booked in February of 2022 against Ian Heinisch. Okay, what are we really doing here? John Volante, you might ask. Well, how does he fit into this one? Since 2017, he's 2-6. Both of those wins are by split decision. I thought Ed Herman beat him. I was there. What do I know? And his last three are a body shot knockout loss to Michael Olszewczyk, who's changed his last name and his fortunes. Big win over Shamil Gamzatov last weekend. He lost to Maurice Greene, where, listen, tiredness played a giant factor in that one. And then he got beat by unanimous decision. You might go, oh, but it was probably really close, though. All three judges, 30-27 to Jake Collier. John Volante has many a performance bonus in his UFC career. And listen, he has a 2015 knockout performance of the night against Beeston 25-8 Corey Anderson that very well could be the next Bellator light heavyweight champ when he takes on Vadim Nemkov to end that tournament. All of this to say, Matt, this is an extreme crossroads fight where Chris Barnett's in this category like a Rocky Martinez, where he's fun, he's athletic, he's big. People make fun of the way that he looks, but I love watching Chris Barnett fight. And John Volante, where he's a shell of what he used to be, which I don't like to say because he actually, like, in person, he seems like a really nice guy.
But that's the issue. When the commentary team mentions your personality as being, like, the big pro, it just, it means that you're probably not in your prime anymore. And listen, John Volante has some good fights. He beat some good fighters in the division. But when Daniel Cormier's first thing is like, oh, this guy's always smiling.
He played football at Hofstra.
Yeah, like, those are really cool facts, but they don't really help you win MMA fights. It's like, John Volante to me right now is in that Vince Carter twilight stage of his career where Vince was good for the Raptors, like amazing for the Raptors, pretty good for New Jersey, although he wasn't efficient. Then he was good for the Mavericks, kind of okay for them, I should say, but he had fallen off. And then, like, the last decade after that, just traveled around from team to team and was a shell of himself. With John Volante, it's like, really? We're letting it go on this long? The UFC's not really doing him a favor at this point. I'm sure he's got a great rapport with Dana White. He seems like a great guy, like you had said. It's just, when John Volante fights now, I don't truly believe that he's in and he's going to have, like, a really competitive performance with really anybody at the UFC level. And for Barnett, I don't look at him as a guy who's going to be in the top 15. He's exactly what you said. He is a fun fighter. And it sucks that just being a fun fighter can't always translate to being a successful fighter in the UFC ranks, because Barnett does have that, like, Javi Ayala-ness to him where it's like, wow, that big guy moves way better than he should. And that's probably going to be able to get him the win in this matchup, but this is going to be one of those fights where people aren't going to like it. If we were doing a fight companion, I would probably no-sell it afterwards, because, listen, if Barnett knocks out John Volante in 30 seconds, it might look really cool, but am I going to change my opinion on him? Not at all. And let's say John Volante somehow gets the win in this matchup, because I got to be honest, I doubt he's going to be able to, but let's say he can grind his way to a decision victory. Then it's not really going to change my opinion of him either, because it's not like I think Barnett's going to go on to be some world beater. So this is just kind of an eh fight for me, but I guess if I have to give the pick, I think Barnett's the more technical guy.
Much more athletic, coming out of Barnett Taekwondo Academy, X3 Sports. He spent a little bit of time there. He's kind of cross-trained a little bit for this camp, and he's a guy that, again, competed at super heavyweight, and he's 5'9". Like, I've got a few inches on him. You've got some inches on him.
Got
like
a lot of inches on him.
It's just weird. You get a heavyweight that's that short in stature, and you saw it in his fight against Ben Rothwell. Probably shouldn't throw spinning wheel kicks, but he did. Did they land? No. But he can do all of those things. The other thing that Barnett does really well, employs a leg kick. Does John Volante do much leg kicking? Not a whole heck of a lot. John Volante is one of those guys, walks you down, throws his boxing combinations, walks back and resets, and that's pretty much it. If I really had to boil it down, Chris Barnett's like watching the Tasmanian Devil if he ate a lot of Halloween candy and had a ton of energy. Like, that's the
point.
Like a Beyblade on Red Bull. Just metal top spinning around. And hopefully kids don't get hurt. That's pretty much what it is. He went to NAIA to wrestle. Andrew Sanchez did that. And so did Corey Anderson, for that matter. And then he ended up going to university after that because they thought, hey, you can play football and you're athletic. So he did. But yeah, when I look at this one, Matt, I mean, Volante open to minus 150. Odds are par right now. Chris Barnett open to plus 130. Odds are par right now. If we look at the topology votes, I suspect that they're relatively close based on where the odds are. But I got to be honest. I wish I could have got Chris Barnett as an underdog. Yeah, 1,025 total votes. Surprised that that many people checked it out. 73% have Barnett to win by knockout for the 24% that have Volante, 59% by decision. We saw Barnett get tired in his last fight. He also got worn on by Ben Rothwell, who had him down to the mat for half that round. And he got back up. And then in the second round, he was really, really tired. But the trouble is, with Barnett, he blitzes forward a lot, and it gets him caught against big guys, against technical strikers. I don't know if I see that happening here. I like Chris Barnett in this fight,
but I think we can both agree. There is a very clear path to victory for Volante. If Barnett gets tired in the first round, just throwing crazy techniques, and if he can't get the stoppage, and if he is an absolute shell of himself, then John Volante, if all else fails, has okay cardio for 205 pounds. I know this is a heavyweight, so I would assume he has okay cardio and heavyweight. Now, I know we're grasping at straws right now, but this is one of those fights. It's not like I can point to a lot on either side. But I could see Jean Volante avoiding getting hit by a big shot and winning a 29-28 decision. I think there's a world out there where that does happen, but I agree. I think Barnett's got this one.
Both of us going with Beast Boy Chris Barnett. Let us know down below if we're wrong. If after the fact we're still wrong, you let me know. I want to hear from you. And make sure you check out Question Mark Kicks. 2 hours before the prelims, if anything changes, we got you covered. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And welcome to the UFC, to Ireland's next big MMA star. You want another Conor McGregor? This could be the guy. You want another worldwide global superstar? I actually think this could be the guy. Matt, we have the former welterweight champ over with Cage Warriors, Ian Garry, set to make his debut against thrice-tried Dana White's Contender Series participant, Jordan Williams, Mr. Beaumaier. Do I like that song by The Game? Yeah. Do I like The Game outside of the rap? I don't know. I don't know him personally, but what I do know, I hope, is MMA. And for Ian Garry, this is a guy that's tested himself both inside the cage and outside of the cage. His amateur career, very short, about a year. He had a great run there. He went, 6-1? So that's pretty cool. Then he's gone 7-0 since he's became a pro in MMA with Cage Warriors. Didn't take that check by Bellator, decided to test himself. And Matt, I wrote down a list of former Cage Warriors welterweight champions. You're not privy to this information. These are my notes. Former champions, Dan Hardy, Pascal Krauss. Where you at, Pascal? Like, seriously, where you at? Nicholas Dalby, Cole Pendred, and, Mason Jones. And that's where I want to go with this, Matt, because I said that Ian Garry's tested himself outside of the cage. He trains at Sanford MMA. He's trained there for a little bit ahead of this fight. I think that's a giant move, and it's unfortunate for certain European fighters that they have to make the move over to the States to get into some of those big camps to get the training done. But he has a perfect blueprint. Wales' Mason Jones was able to do the same thing. Work out a Team Alpha Male. Get a little bit of the wrestling in with your striking. You saw how that worked for Jones, especially in his last fight against David Onama, where you get cracked on the feet. Hey, let's take it down to the mat. But Matt, for Ian Garry, I watched this guy's performances, and I'm absolutely blown away. If you can't hear it from my voice, I don't often kind of buy into the hype. I tried not to watch the promo videos out there on Instagram, on his website, whatever. I just focused on the fights. Man, this guy's good.
Yeah, he's legit. And they're not doing Jordan Williams any favors right now, because Williams had a little bit of hype coming into the UFC. I don't feel like he was a massive star by any means, but they don't match up with a guy like Mickey Gall just because they think you're going to be a one-and-done star in the UFC. And that's what I'm going to get back to. I thought he had such a great opportunity to at least establish himself as more than just an unranked guy in that fight. I really thought that, hey, Mickey Gall hasn't shown much of a progression.
Jordan Williams is a minus 175 favorite in that one.
Exactly, and I thought, hey, he's going to be able to go in there, blow the doors off Mickey Gall, and just look phenomenal. And the thing is, when you fight a guy like Mickey Gall, like a Sage Northcutt, just any of those guys who got any sort of a promotional push from the UFC, it's going to give you some shine. Now, did Jordan Williams make the most of that opportunity? Not at all. Got taken down very quick and got submitted. And it was basically one of those, like, worst-case scenarios through and through, and this is my problem. It feels like the UFC only kept Jordan Williams to feed him to Ian Garry right now. And we can break down what Ian Garry does well. It's everything Jordan Williams doesn't. If Ian Garry could go out there, be the aggressive fighter that he's shown before, strike his way into his takedowns, and implement his phenomenal ground and pound. And that is the thing about Ian Garry. He's the type of guy who doesn't just get control time on the top. They're not going to bring up how, Ian Garry got a minute and 20 seconds of control time, and he probably won the round that way. He's going to use that top pressure. He's going to make you pay for when he is on top. And I love the move to Sanford MMA, because who's another fighter who had, I don't want to say identical games to Ian Garry, but I would say they had somewhat similar games. A much bigger guy, though, moved down to Sanford MMA, and he has added some striking to his game.
Maybe Brendan Allen?
Brendan Allen! Now, if Ian Garry can show some of that same evolution down there with Sanford MMA, I agree 100%. I think he's shown the foundation of being an absolute superstar in this division one day, and if he can add some of that Sanford MMA, not just striking IQ, I think we've got a real contender on our hands.
See, I feel like I have a little bit of bias, and again, I bought into the hype, so have that as a giant general warning for this fight, because I am incredibly impressed with what this guy does, impressed by the fact that, hey, at 23, almost 24, he made the move over to the States to get ready for a fight like this. Awesome. Credit where it's due. Both of these guys have had their successes outside of the cage too and viral videos. Ian Garry, it was unfortunately with his grandfather that has dementia. They sang Imagine by John Lennon. And if you didn't cry for that one, that was sad. And for Jordan Williams, he was the one that had a hard time getting insulin, getting those fights on Contender Series. And you look at it, he beats Tim Caron, but then it ends up a no contest because he tests positive for the weed. He loses to Ramazan Kurumagomedov that was supposed to end up in the UFC to fight Alex Oliveira. I still have that video squirreled away in case I ever need it. But listen, that fight didn't end up his way. And then he fights a guy that, listen, we all know and love, Gregory Rodriguez. And what happens? He knocks him out quick. So it's kind of crazy to look at it for Jordan Williams that way. He's a blood and guts type of fighter. The loss in the UFC too. Nassourdine Imavov, who has an awesome opportunity to win this weekend against a guy who's had a lot of hype too, and Edmund Shabazian. And then Mickey Gall. So it's really tough to tell exactly where he's at. But the level of competition for Ian Garry since he's become a pro, pretty darn good. He fought in that kind of four-man tournament for the belt that they had because Mason Jones vacated. So automatically you ended up with Jack Grant. And you ended up with Rostam Akman. You know, the guy who wore the hair sweater, but that was his body. Yikes. And in that fight, Ian Garry's like, man, I'm going to put on a great performance. And I want to give credit where it's due, too, because, listen, MMA on Point puts out great stuff. And Pete C. Carroll, you know him and love him, had a great piece on Ian Garry as a prospect before that Rostam Akman fight. And in that, Ian's like, listen, I want to go out, impress everybody. I know I got to get the finish. I got to beat a former UFC guy. And in that one, he did exactly that. Then he fought Jack Grant, a guy who's fought a ton of really good competition. Now, Grant came up to take that fight, so he's not really a welterweight, but in that one, Garry wins a five-round decision. I like that from a cardio perspective, so there's a lot of things that I really like. That fight was only 4 months ago, but again, I can go on and on and on. Started boxing at 10, started judo, became a black belt too after that, and then he mixed in the MMA. I don't know what more I can say, but really when it boils down to this one, again, a lot of bias because I bought into the hype. I like Ian Garry in this one.
I guess this is my question for you. Do you think we'll ever see Garry move up to 185 pounds? Because he is a really young guy. He has a big frame for this weight class. It's been something in the back of my mind a little bit. I would hate to see him really gain a lot of momentum at welterweight just for his body to kind of decide, hey, I'm almost too big for this weight class. That's the only thing that I'm a little bit concerned about with him fighting at this weight class. I do look at him and I do see a potential future at 185 pounds because think of like Darren Till. Came over from Cage Warriors, had a lot of success, had a lot of hype behind him. But he hadn't really grown into his body before he came to the UFC. And then we saw he almost grew a little bit too fast. And now we see he doesn't really fit in at middleweight. Listen, I think Ian Garry has a higher ceiling than Darren Till. And I know that's wild to say because Darren Till at one point people thought was going to be a champion. And I do like him quite a bit in this fight. Just that's always something that's sort of in the back of my mind.
The odds, Garry open a minus 290 favorite, roughly a minus 363 on best fight odds. For Williams, open a plus 235. He's now a plus 277. The votes on Tapology, haven't looked at them. I'm assuming over 90% Garry.
I'd agree, yeah.
Yeah, look at that. 1,040 total votes. 94% Garry, 68% by knockout. For the 6% that have Williams, 47% by decision, 38% by knockout. I can't stress this enough. Ton of bias. I bought into the hype, so I'm already on that train. I've got Ian Garry in this fight.
Whether you're biased or not, it's just Jordan Williams does have a lot of ways to win this fight.
Knockout.
But a knockout's really tough to do against a guy who's never been knocked out before, who's defensively sound on the feet, and who has dominant wrestling in his back pocket. It's really, really tough ass to do, and this is why it's weird matchmaking. It's odd to me that they're giving a guy in a two-fight losing streak a former champion with a ton of hype behind him. This feels like the UFC is almost setting Ian Garry up to have a massive debut and then really set him up for the future.
Both of us going with Ireland's Ian Garry in this fight. I can't wait for it. Sanford MMA definitely represented on the map in this big time card, UFC 268, question mark kicks. It's 2 hours before the prelims. You can find it right here on the channel. If you're not subscribed already, you hit subscribe. You hit the bell notification, then you know when we're going live. If you ever have any questions or doubts, big time fight weeks. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Absolute banger at middleweight. One of my favorite fights on this card that is probably not going to get talked about enough, and that's because the man on the left-hand side of the screen, Edmund Shabazian, is one of those guys that all of a sudden, all the hype's wiped out because you lose to Derek Brunson in a fight where your cardio kind of abandons you. And if you look at it for Edmund, he goes out there his next time out, takes on Jack Hermanson, and then the same thing happens, and he gets 10-8'd in the third round. And then when I look at his record, that's when I start to poke holes. I mean, realistically, I mean, yeah, you can get a lot of first-round finishes, and that's the biggest thing for him. But as his career has progressed, that's been kind of it. And Edmund was able to win the first round against Derek Brunson.
We're really starting out negative.
He had a really good first round against Hermanson as well. But then once that tide starts to roll against him, the cardio's been an issue, which is a shame, because for a guy that's a couple weeks away from his 24th birthday, that's not something that we normally see. So for Edmund, he gets an opportunity to kind of right the ship. It's just not against a really easy test. And for Edmund, he's ranked in this division. You still get to keep that, hold that over your head. But also remember that Felice Herrig just jumped a ranking spot, and she hasn't won a fight since 2017. So that's what I think about the UFC rankings. For Nassourdine Imavov, coming out of the MMA factory in France, his teammate's the champ. With an asterisk, zero gone, but he's got great guys to train there. Fernand Lopez, the big-time coach. And for Imavov, we've talked about him since maybe even before he came into the UFC. He got a big win over Jonathan Mounier, his friends call him Joe, and in that fight, he looked like the Russian sniper that we know and love. Since he's come into the UFC, his only loss, a majority decision to Phil Haas, who's also on this card, 28-28. 229-28, it's a close fight. All right, you struggle a little bit with your takedown defense. So what does he do in his next fight? He defends Ian Heinisch's takedown attempts, and he finishes him. And Nasruddin's not a giant guy. Like, he's tall for this division, but he's not the thickest-looking guy for this division. Man, Matt, Nasruddin Imavov's stock is at an all-time high. Edmund Shabazian's at a buy-low situation, so that's what makes this fight so interesting to me.
I feel like we have to remind ourselves of what the highs of Shabazian at least were at the time, because a lot of people are really down on him. I have seen not many positive tweets or really anything about Edmund Shabazian throughout the past few weeks. It's just been a lot of, hey, remember how hyped up this guy was? And it's true, like, if you took a drink every single time you saw that training video of young Edmund Shabazian with Ronda Rousey, you would have probably passed away by now, because the UFC loves to promote that over and over and over again.
Why are you watching that?
It's just, every time they show Edmund Shabazian, it's, hey, you know, he's been training with Ronda Rousey for years now, and he was one of her original training partners in all of her, like, media workouts when she was champ. Like, Edmund's been around the sport for a little while now, and you gotta remember, he's one of the OG Glendale Fighting Club gym guys. Like, it was, this is Ronda Rousey's gym, that she kind of faded into obscurity, and then Edmund was the new face of the gym, and he was a really exciting prospect. When you think about Edmund, you do have to bring up his accuracy on the feet. It is really impressive. He throws really nice straight shots up the middle. And when I go back to Edmund Shabazian, I always have to tell myself, like, hey, you can't knock out Brad Tavares in the first round by accident. I know there's been some really low lows and there's been some really high highs. So I don't know if Edmund Shabazian is going to become the next Michael Olashaychuk, where if we just want to talk about the positives, we're like, wow, this guy could be a future top 10. And then if we just want to talk about the negatives, you're like, oh, were we really supposed to get excited about him in the first place? It's just, I don't know how much stock we should put into these two fights. And it is the Brad Tavares win. It's the Derek Brunson loss. Because, listen, Nassourdine Imavov doesn't fight anything like Derek Brunson. Derek Brunson can put a pace on you. He can mix in his wrestling. He's a much more aggressive striker, I'd say, on the feet. So he can at least make you work a little bit more. And that's why I'm going to pass it off to you with this. Do you think Imavov can put enough pace on Shabazian so that his cardio really will be a factor? Because that's the only thing that I worry about with Imavov in this matchup. I don't think he himself throws enough strikes on the feet to really force Edmund to have a crazy high work rate.
When he's on, he's in and out really quick, and he can bop, bop, back out of the way, get out of all those big shots. Maybe he could get caught on one of those, you know, long-range kicks, long-range attacks out of Edmund, because Shabazian has those. But for me, I like Imavov on the outside. He's a guy that, like, you saw it on the weekend, and this is a poor example because he lost the fight. But look at Corey Sandhagen before he started to slow down a little bit and Piotr Jan took over. What was he doing? In and out. on the outside, never really moving the same way. Imavov, if he's on, can do similar things to that at middleweight, something that you don't see every single day. But for Edmund, I look at it, every single win is a first-round stoppage, except for one win that he got over Darren Stewart in his UFC debut on the Ultimate Fighter finale, where a lot of people thought Stewart won that fight, because what happened in that fight, too? He crescendos, and then we're going to downzos.
But that's the weird thing about that fight. Edmund became a wrestler all of a sudden, and it's been weird. We haven't really seen that wrinkle in his game after that fight. Now, yes, he is a good wrestler, and he is one of those weird categories where it's not like Shabazian has a background in anything. He is sort of that Rory McDonald mindset where it's like, hey, you're not a karate guy who then became an MMA fighter. You're not a natural wrestler who then got into MMA. You just are an MMA fighter, and it will be really interesting to see if Shabazian will have success in the feat against Imavov, because if early on, if he isn't able to establish his jab, throw some of his own kicks in there, and keep Imavov on his back foot, I think Shabazian should be able to fight at least a consistent enough pace to where his cardio won't fall off a cliff in the second and third round. But the real key is going to be, can Imavov make Shabazian work? Because that's what his last two opponents have been able to do. I don't necessarily think Shabazian has awful cardio. I think he was fighting two guys who could really force him to fight with a high work rate. Jack Hermanson's shown that in the past. He outworked Jacare Souza throughout a 5-round fight. Just because I'm saying it doesn't mean I'm right. I'm just saying he fought two guys who have a much better ability to really put a pace on him than Imavov does. That's my only concern. I think Imavov's the more technical striker. I think he has the better movement on the feet. I just don't know if he throws enough strikes to really make Shabazian tired.
For Edmund in that fight against Hermanson, you want to talk about going to the deep waters. 4 minutes and 14 seconds of control in the third round alone. 99-4 the total strikes. So that really is the question. And for Edmund, losing two in a row, again, you're buying low at the opportunity, and that's really what it is. For Imavov, coming off of a big finish win over Ian Heinisch, maybe not the easiest thing to do either. You look at the loss again, Phil Hawes, beat Jordan Williams by decision, looked good in that fight, beat Jonathan Mounier, a guy that was in the UFC with a loss to Colby Covington, so it has been decent competition for Imavov, too.
And the more I do think about it, Imavov could fight like he fought against Phil Hawes. Now, yes, he didn't look good early in that fight, but the way that fight became close was he came on really strong at the end of it. So there is a world out there where Shabazian does throw a lot of his power shots early, gets tired throwing a lot of head kicks and body kicks, misses a lot, and then Imavov is able to capitalize as the fight goes on. I'm curious where you think the tide really does shift. Do you think Shabazian can have success for the first 7-8 minutes of the matchup, or do you think he's going to have to go in there with kind of that MMA mindset, thinking, hey, I might need to shoot takedowns, I might need to strike?
I think the leg kicks are going to be a big difference for Imavov in this fight, and that's where, you know, you're putting water in the basement, the old Teddy Atlas adage. So for me, I look at the odds here. Shabazian open to -150. He's now a +111. Sometimes I'll struggle with names throughout the video, even though they're up in my head. Edmonds is one of them. It's been a career thing. For Nasruddin Imavov, open to +130. He's -136. One of the bigger movers and shakers on the card. As far as the Tapology votes, surprise to us as they are to you. And they're close. 1,124 of them. 58% with Edmund. 57% by decision. 32% by knockout. For the 42% that have Imavov, 52% by decision. 33% by knockout. If you're of the 58% that have Shabazian, and you 57% think he's going to win by decision, he's only won one of those in his 11 fights as winning contests, I guess I should say. I have a hard time seeing it. I think he's got to go out there and knock out Imavov. For Imavov, got a pretty good chin, can take some shots, but Edmund has a ton of power. So this fight to me is really, really close. I know I've talked a little bit more about Imavov than I had for Shabazian, but man, this guy's a wrecking ball. Like, I haven't talked about it. The UFC wins. Let's go last three. Charles Byrd, no longer in the UFC, but he finished him. Jack Marshman submitted him, no longer in the UFC. Brad Tavares knocked him out quick, and I made some cheddar off of that one because I parlayed Rozenstruik and Shabazian, and I looked like a smart man that night. A smart man indeed. But Matt, when it comes to this one, I do actually have a very hard time on it.
Oh, this is as close of a 50-50 fight as there is on the whole entire card, because I can see a world where Imavov is able to use his movement, really work on the outside, make Shabazian miss early and often, and then really take over in the second and third round. My issue with Imavov, though, is I don't know how good his punching power is compared to Shabazian's. I know he knocked out Ian Heinisch, but that was one of those weird shots where Ian Heinisch was kind of moving into it. So I don't know if Imavov can go out there and really hurt Shabazian with a shot, is what I'm trying to say. I think if Imavov wins, it probably will be decision. And I do agree with you. If Shabazian wins, it probably will be by stoppage. All week long, I've been thinking Imavov is going to win, but I do think, just personally, I think I've been too down on Shabazian. I don't think he's going to have the problem of, hey, I'm going to be fighting a grappler. It's going to be in the back of his head that I won't really be able to unload with my own strikes because my opponent will be able to shoot in on my hips. I think I've kind of talked myself into a Shabazian pick, even though I didn't think I was going to come close to picking Edmund this week.
Shabazian, from the Instagrams over the last couple of months, he's trained at AKA. He's trained at Gracie Baja Tarzana. He's trained at the PI in Vegas. This fight, obviously, in New York. So a little bit of cross-training there. I don't know how much it's going to help him, especially foundationally. And I'm assuming in his corner, it's going to be the same old, same old. We'll see how that one shakes out. This is Monday, of course, when we tape these. For me, I've got Nasruddin Imavov based on the consistency and only that. Now, has he beaten a ranked fighter? No. Did he beat Phil Haas? Well, at best, he drew with him, and at worst, he lost the majority decision. So it really is tough to try and cap the potential. I think both these guys are going to be around for a while, but for me, I like Imavov with that movement on the outside, with the pressure that he can put on as the fight goes on. I just think those are good keys to have. So for me, I'm going with France's own Nasruddin Imavov, the Russian sniper. You're going with the golden boy, Edmund Shabazian. I think this should be a great fight. On a great fight card, some big ones, two title fights, both rematches at the top. Gaethje taking on Chandler, you're not going to want to miss any of it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Not the fight you knew you needed, but you need it nonetheless. We have Megatron, Phil Haas, not Calvin Johnson, taking on the Action Man, Chris Curtis. Chris Curtis is finally in the UFC.
Yes.
And if you're an MMA fan from 2018, you're as excited as I am because, listen, if you watched a lot of Contender Series from the outset, Curtis was one of the highlight reel guys. And yeah, it's pretty well in his nickname, but it was one of the bigger disappointments in MMA when he wins his fight on Contender Series and then he doesn't get a contract and he retires. And it was just really, really disappointing. He was only retired for about 6 months. Then he beat Matt Dwyer, that was in the UFC at one point. He beats Andre Fiallo, who I like, with PFL. And then he goes on to lose to Magomed Kerimov, Ray Cooper the third, Magomed Kerimov. Anybody's gonna lose them. They're gonna lose to each other. That's how good they are. But they are some of the best welterweights in the world. Key there is welterweight. And so Chris Curtis, since then, 2020 and 2021, he's won four fights in a row. He's won five fights in a row. Four of them are by finish. He's fought for XMMA, a big win over Kyle Stewart that was in the UFC. His last time out was a fight back on my birthday, July 30th. Send best wishes over Kenny Robertson at welterweight. He wins that fight. He was booked to take on Ty Freeman, but that fight fell out because ultimately, he ends up in the UFC. He's going to fight Phil Haas. Now, why did that fight happen? Because Daron Wynn. That's why that fight happened. Daron Wynn was supposed to fight Phil Haas a couple of different times. The fights fell out. Curtis was going to take the fight on the Friday of weigh-ins. And then I got the graphics ready, and then it didn't happen. So now we're here. Ultimately, Chris Curtis finally gets a call to take on Phil Haas, who, I don't know, Rashad Evans was talking about like 10 years ago when he had my ear. And then he lost to Julian Marquez. This is Phil Haas here on Contender Series very early on. And I went, oh, okay, so the hype wasn't real. No, the hype's pretty real. And for Phil Haas in his last five fights, big wins over Yuri Fraga, over Kachimret Bastaev, a guy who just won with Bellator, over Jacob Malkoon, yikes, over Nasruddin Imavov. And then his last time out over Kyle Daukaus, Matt, I like the fight, but they're two different weight classes. I mean, yeah, Chris Curtis is a big guy, but man, he's got a blood and gut style, and I don't know how it's going to translate to middleweight.
I was going to say, I like the opportunity. I'm not sure if I'm in love with the fight, because Chris Curtis is going to eat some shots. That's a guarantee in this matchup. He's going to eat shots. He was going to eat punches down at 170 pounds. Now he's fighting up a weight class that he doesn't really belong in against a huge middleweight. And that's the thing about Phil Haas. He might only be, 2 inches taller than Chris Curtis? In my mind's eye, he probably weighs 20 pounds more by the night of the actual weigh-ins. Because Phil Haas, he's built like a brick house, especially for this weight class. And he's shown the ability to, A, defend takedowns from big guys at this weight class, shown the ability to land power shots. Really, the only thing I worry about with Haas is his gas tank against, like, elite guys in this weight division. But when he's fighting guys making their UFC debut who just don't really belong in the weight class, it feels like Chris Curtis is almost starting this fight with like a 2-point deduction, if anything. He's fighting out from a really, really big lead. So It's a good opportunity for Curtis. It's nice to see him in the UFC. He's a guy who's really been around the regional scene. And like you mentioned, he's retired multiple times. And the fact that he has now been able to get up to the UFC after facing so much adversity is very, very admirable. It's like we saw last week with Glover Teixeira, like a 42-year-old who's lost fights.
Look at us.
Exactly. He's reinvented himself and now he's come back. Same thing with Chris Curtis. Like, yesterday doesn't define your tomorrow. It's just a lot when you're coming in and fighting Phil Hawes at a week's notice. Like, we were talking before we started filming. When you beat Kyle Daukaus, you're probably ready for those, maybe not ranked fighters, but you get the idea. Those, like, 15 to 25 guys. Then if you win one of those fights, then you're probably ready for, like, a main card slot or a pay-per-view, maybe. Just, you know, like, a big opportunity against a good name. That's not what Phil Hawes is doing right now, so that's why it's just weird matchmaking.
Tuesday's gone. Gone with the wind, and when I really do look at this from another Lynyrd Skynyrd perspective, it's, ooh, that smell! When I was a kid, I thought, what are they? But the smell is defeat. The smell is defeat. When I look at this one, Matt, the odds, I wrote them down, minus 350 for Haas at open, minus 334 now. For Chris Curtis, open to plus 275. Plus 255 on best fight odds. Tapology votes, I'm going to say over under 85%.
Haas. I would say over, yeah.
90% out of 1,004 total votes, 90% Haas, 45% by decision, 46% by knockout. For the 10% that have Curtis, 59% by knockout. All right, boys, you talk a big game. You like Chris Curtis, but you didn't tell us how he's going to win if he is going to win. I'll tell you exactly how he's going to win. By setting a pace and fighting at his own pace. When you watch Chris Curtis at his best, and I've watched a lot of Chris Curtis lately on the regional scene, those XMMA shows, if you're not watching them, it's free fights.
It's decent level of competition.
It's good level of competition. A lot of old UFC guys, Andre Fiallo fought there. And the production quality is really good too. So I've enjoyed them, but I have been following Chris Curtis because, hey, I like Dana White's Contender Series and I like watching Chris Curtis. When he fights at his best, stringing combinations together, but setting that pace on a fighter and a guy like Carl Stewart, that's not easy to do, and Chris Curtis does it, and he picks his shots. He can rip the body. Once he backs you up to the cage, he can really pick you apart and then start chopping leg kicks in there. Switch stances a little bit. Give one to take one, and he does have a pretty good chin. I know, obviously, you know, that's cost him in some fights, but that's what he's really good at, and I think at 170 it's going to be great. I just don't know how that translates. I see Phil Hawes going out there, and if he's got to put the wrestling shoes on, have a lot of success, and then win a fight. So for me, I like Phil Hawes. It's a little bit too much for Curtis, but man, if he blows the doors off of Phil Hawes, the sky's the limit. I would be impressed. Obviously, I'm going to be watching this fight either way, but I really like this one. But man, the deck is stacked against Chris Curtis. I have a hard time picking him.
It's just a really hard debut. How many times have we said this recently where it's like, this guy should be really good. It's just, this is an awful opportunity given to them by the UFC. Kind of like with Benoit St. Denis last weekend. Like, hey, he could be a good fighter down at 155 pounds. So why are you giving him an absolute killer at 170? It's just, it's weird matchmaking. This reminds me a lot of that. I could see Curtis being a successful welterweight, but the fact that they're giving him such a dangerous middleweight is doing him no favors. And I like Phil Hawes quite a bit.
Hopefully Kislev is not the referee in this fight, like Benoit St. Denis, whose corner today said, you know what? No.
Yeah, we wouldn't have thrown in the towel no matter what.
Good to know, guy. Good to know. At least he knows his fighter. But Matt, in this fight, both of us going with Megatron, Phil Hawes to catch that touchdown pass from Matthew Stafford for like 90 yards. Throwing it back to you poor Lions fans. Yeah, both of us going Hawes in this one. Make sure you check out Question Mark Kicks 2 hours before the prelims. The QMK getting moving on Saturday. I love it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. OG lightweight fans, we have a fight for you coming up this weekend. Raging Al Iaquinta is back and in action. He's going to be taking on King Bobby Green. And it's kind of crazy to think, you look at these guys' overall records, that, hey, their paths have never really crossed before. I mean, if you do look at it for Al, let's pick on some of the wins. I mean, hey, Kevin Lee, big-time win there. Times two. He beat Jorge Masvidal. He beat Diego Sanchez by finish. He's lost to Dan Hooker and Donald Cerrone. But we can forget about that. Al's last win in 2018 was against future champion Kevin Lee. And you can't take that one away from him. He lost a decision in Submission Underground to Mike Perry earlier on in 2020. Like, that's all I can say about Al lately, other than the fact that he has a podcast with Al Iaquinta Realty from Twitter. You know him as Aaron. But yeah, I don't have a whole lot more to say about Al. Sometimes he's featured in Instagram stories when him and Aljamain Sterling go to Georgia with Merab Dvalishvili. And if you could be a fly on the wall of those parties, I bet they're absolute insanity. But other than that, with Al, I expect him to be in fight shape. I expect him to be fight ready. And sometimes you win fights against Kevin Lee a couple of times, and sometimes you get weird title fights against Khabib Nurmagomedov because the commission believes in the UFC's rankings. And that's just silliness. Oh! And it's in that, this fight's in that state, but none of those things all go together. Bobby Green has been very, very active lately and put on a good case and a good showing in his last fight against Rafael Fiziev, where he turned it on at the end of that fight, and man, was that ever a fun one to watch.
That was a phenomenal fight, and that really is the thing about Bobby Green. Has he ever been in a boring one? Because I certainly can't think of one off the
top
of my head.
Too many shoulder rolls, maybe?
But it's even that's fun to watch. Like, I could just watch Bobby Green be defensive for 15 minutes and probably really enjoy it. Green does have a really unique way of boxing, and that's what everybody's going to mention. He does have that really unique shoulder roll. He does like to counter with hooks off that shoulder roll, and it does accentuate his power quite a bit because it helps his momentum, because he'll roll with a shot and then respond with power on that back hand. And he's a really unique fighter because he's got a good jab from both stances too. I don't really think he gets credit for that because a lot of boxers are known for they only fight from this style, or they fight orthodox or southpaw, and they won't switch styles as much. I know it's a lot more prevalent nowadays in boxing, but for the longest time, you were just kind of set in your ways. With Bobby Green, he is able to fight from an orthodox and a southpaw position, and he's got good output from both. Like, how many times have we talked about a guy like Wonderboy Thompson where it's like, hey, from orthodox, he's got good techniques, but they're a little bit different than what he does from southpaw. He is a slightly different fighter from both stances. With Green, it's just a crazy amount of boxing volume no matter what he does, and that's why his fights are always so fun. And in the Fiziev fight, you did see him struggle early on against the more explosive Muay Thai fighter. He had trouble because with Green, he's not the fastest guy in the world. He doesn't have crazy knockout power, but he's got really good timing on his shots. If you do jump in and out of range, he's somebody who will time you on your way in and then start to mount volume on you when you try to exit that range. So he does have that really fan-friendly style, and that's why I think this could be fight of the night when things are all said and done. I know it's been a good layoff for Ally Quinta, and he hasn't been the most active throughout this later stage of his career, but you can't forget about what the things Al's really good at. He's a great counter-wrestler. He's got phenomenal takedown defense. He's a very active fighter, and this is the thing I'll say. I can tell you exactly what Ally Quinta does well, but it's not flashy at all. He's got slow hands. He doesn't really have great knockout power. Like, none of his X factors are really that impressive, but he is able to win fights because he's just so well-rounded. And he's one of the best examples, I would say, in the whole UFC of, if you're a striker, I'm going to take you down. And if you're a really good wrestler, I can force this fight to be on the feet for a solid 15 minutes. The issue I have with Al, though, and from what we've seen as of late, is guys who can really mix in their kicks and guys who specialize with their striking are normally good enough to defend his takedown defense, or his takedown attempts, because with Al, it feels like his takedown defense is still at a very high level, but offensively, he does seem to be lacking with his own takedown attempts. When you go back and think about Ally Quinta, especially through his last two fights, Cowboy Cerrone and Dan Hooker have two weaknesses in their games. You can take them down if you are a really good wrestler, and Al struggled a lot in that aspect in both those fights. So I do think we're going to see a primary boxing matchup in this fight. So it really just begs the question, who do you think is the better boxer, Ally Quinta or Bobby Green?
And I mean, in this one too, both guys, it should be noted, have great takedown defense. True. You see that from Bobby Green. Go back to the Clay Guida fight, and all he has to do, he's got that wide base. He just extends his feet out. He's able to kind of get the underhooks in there, lift the opponent back up, and Bob's your uncle, or whatever your uncle's name is, weird uncle Jim, I don't know. You look at the 5-on-in for both of these guys. For Green, a win over Clay Guida, as I mentioned, the win over Lando Venata, big surprise there. A win over Alon Patrick, where he looked amazing. A loss to Thiago Moises, but again,
it was surprisingly close.
Moises, and then the Fiziev fight, that's a unanimous decision loss, but a lot of people were salty about it on Twitter after the fact, thought that he 10-8'd him in the third round. Fiziev kind of blew his load and got a little tired. For Al, Matt, the fifth to last fight, 4.5 years ago against Diego Sanchez, and that's just it. The inactivity of Ally Quinta, if you look at the 5-on-in, he still has a Khabib fight on that record. How many fights did Khabib have after that? Many, many, but not for Al. Al didn't really fight a whole lot after that one. So the inactivity does scare me a little bit. I look at the odds, they open fairly close. Green, a minus 130 favorite, minus 171 right now. For Raging Al Ally Quinta, open a plus 110. He's a plus 141.
They both only had 3 fights since then.
Yeah, but I mean, one guy's been retired for quite
still,
a while.
Still, I'm just saying.
Like, they've had specials about his retirement. For Al, he's got a show, and I like it. And he answers questions and takes calls. He's like the next Ariel Helwani. But I look at the Tapology votes for this one. 1,168 total votes, 62% Green, 87% by decision for the 38% that have Al, 83% by decision. Maybe you want to hang your hat on that decision prop. I'd be fine with that too. You talked about it. Neither one of these guys have finished fights all that recently. I mean, for Al, again, you can call me Betty. Betty, you can call me Al. 4.5 years ago, he finished Diego Sanchez, and that's when a lot of people thought Diego was done, so there is that. But I like Bobby Green in this fight, the activity I like. But again, I just want to throw this sprinkle out there. I've been wrong about fighters taking longer layoffs before. Jessica Penne is the first one that comes to mind when she fought Lupita Godinez, depending on how you saw that fight at the end of it. Penne still ended up with a W on her record. So again, for Al, I have a hard time seeing it his way because I like what I've seen out of Green, and I can even pick spots in those losses like we kind of alluded to that, oh, okay, he can do this. Oh, okay, he can still do that in those losses. So I like Green in this fight. I think, again, pitter-patter, he's going to be able to get it done. But if Al's able to go out there and pressure, great opportunity for him here.
I agree with Bobby Green, and I think he is going to win. But if we're going to, like, take positives from losses, Al Iaquinta did pretty good against Khabib Nurmagomedov, who's, like, the greatest fighter of all time.
He shouldn't box. What's he doing boxing?
I'm just saying, if we're going to say, oh, Bobby Green looked good in his losses, then, like, Al Iaquinta looked all right in some of his losses, too. So I think we should give him that credit as well. The thing I will say about Al, though, is it feels like his last two fights, he has fallen off a little bit. Yeah, and I don't know if it's because of the damage he took in the Khabib fight, or if it is just he's more dedicated to, I don't even want to call it a side gig anymore, because he does seem to be a fairly successful real estate agent in the state of New York. So I just don't know if he's all that dedicated to being like the lightweight champion anymore. And that's fine. He's 34. He has a very successful business outside the UFC. I still think Bobby Green is trying to get into the rankings, though. I know he's a little bit older, but I do think he's slightly more dedicated to the MMA game as a whole. He's been much more active as of late. And like you said, he put up competitive performances against guys like Moises and Fazeev, who are considered two good, good fighters in this division. I wouldn't say great. I say they're half a step short of that, but still very solid fighters. So I do like the recent activity of Bobby Green, and I think he's going to be the more active fighter throughout this fight. I think it's going to be a great fight, and Al Iaquinta is probably not going to get knocked out. He's going to be there for all three rounds, but I do like the activity and the work rate of Bobby Green.
Absolutely love the fight. Both of us going with California's own Bobby Green to get the win. Let us know down below who you have in this fight. A couple of pesky lightweight veterans going at it. Big time card coming up. Lightweights up near the top. Gaethje Chandler, you're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
His name's Alex Pereira, and he's truly one of the most terrifying human beings.
Bad motherfucker.
Oh.
With those kind words from Joe Rogan from the JRE podcast, let's give credit where it is definitely due. We have one of the biggest UFC debuts in forever, maybe. Alex Pereira making his debut, the first ever simultaneous two-division glory champion at middleweight, then the interim light heavyweight champ, then he won the full-time belt. Forget about the rematch that he had where he lost it, that wasn't that long ago, but it was by decision. That's all right. He's going to be making his debut, taking on Greece's own Andreas Mihailidis, a teammate of Colby Covington that's also on this card out of MMA Masters. And if we're talking about pure camp styles for Mihailidis, you get Covington, you get Miguel Baeza, Danny Chavez trains there too. A lot of notable UFC fighters out of a not so big gym down in the Miami area. But for Alex Pereira, he trains at Teixeira MMA and Fitness. And until last weekend, you might have gone, oh, okay, well, that's pretty good. I mean, who's there? Ciel Machado, like there's some guys. Oh yeah, that light heavyweight champion of the world trains there alongside him in Glover Teixeira. So credit where credit's due for Teixeira. I don't know how many people saw that coming, but there's not that many of you out there. Now, Matt, Alex Pereira is coming into this fight with a giant head of steam. And if you look at just his overall MMA record, it's 3-1. He lost his first ever fight. He took a long time off between MMA fights, but since then he's looked good. His last MMA fight was in 2020, November of that year. Oh. Giant knockout win, very quick in that. But here's the thing. The overall record in kickboxing, 33-7. 21 wins by knockout. Matt, this guy's hands are lightning fast, and we talked about it before the video even started. His power's off the charts.
When he lands any technique, it sounds like thunder. It really does. Like body kicks, even hooks that seem to like hit his opponent's gloves. It sounds like two metal bats hitting each other. That's the type of power that this guy brings into the cage. And he had massive knockout power with boxing gloves on in a kickboxing setting. So you'd have to imagine with only 4-ounce gloves, just how powerful of a striker that this guy must be. And you don't even just have to worry about the hands with him. It is the kick combinations. He does have beautiful combinations with his hands too. But like you said, this might be one of the more hyped up debuts in recent memory. Like, I remember when Gokhan Saki fought, who was it? It was the Brazilian
Luis Enrique.
Thank you. Luis Enrique, who didn't have the best run in the UFC, who oddly did well to start out that fight, but we all remember the crazy highlight reel knockout that Sakai had. Now, did Gokhan Sakai have the most successful MMA career? No, not really, because he really was just like a kickboxer who decided to put on MMA gloves. And I do think Pereira will have a more successful MMA tenure. But this is what I will say about Alex Pereira and just his striking as a whole. I think he's a better kickboxer than Israel Adesanya. I think he's a better pure kickboxer than most guys in the UFC. I do think he's going to have a hard time, or at least a few growing pains early on in his UFC tenure, because what we saw out of Adesanya was a guy who had multiple MMA fights in the regional scene. He had fought guys like Melvin Gallard, who, yes, isn't really a middleweight, but still an experienced guy who had been around and just been around the scene for a while. If you beat guys like that, you're at least learning and sort of upgrading your own MMA IQ as you progress, and that's what I really liked at Adesanya. He waited, and then he eased himself into the UFC. The thing I do worry about with Pereira is that, yes, his striking isn't even a 10 out of 10. It is a 90 out of 10. It's at another level that really nobody else in the UFC is going to reach, because he spent so much of his life just purely striking. What I do worry about are the intangibles. I don't think he's going to have that knockout takedown defense and the lights out takedown defense that Adesanya showed early on. I don't think he has the footwork of a guy like Adesanya, because Pereira is more of a plodding forward striker. He is somebody who really marches forward, likes to throw his combinations, start things with leg kicks. And I do think that that's going to... Listen, if he fought Andrew Sanchez, I know he's no longer in the UFC, like, that's a matchup I would really worry about for Pereira. Now, do I think he's going to have a hard time with Andreas Michailidis? I really don't. This is somebody who neither one of us was all that high on coming into the UFC. And yes, he has a good win over KB Buller, but again, that was another guy who, I know we were both fairly critical on the UFC, so for me, this just feels like one of those, hey, this guy beat Israel Adesanya, we're going to use that to market it in the future. I think we all know what I'm getting towards. It just feels like this is a stepping stone matchup for Pereira in his UFC debut.
For Poatan, you look at it, he didn't just beat Israel Adesanya, he knocked him out. And he didn't just knock him out, he also beat him in 2016 by decision, too. He's got two wins over Israel Adesanya in pure kickboxing.
Wait, you must be a Joe Rogan fan.
He's taken on some big names. Simon Marcus, big win there.
Canadian.
Bazooka Joe Valtellini. Glory Hall of Famer has announced some of his fights. But yeah, I mean, when I go through this for Andreas Michailidis, I was a little bit critical of him coming into the UFC. I know he had that fight against Modestus Bukauskas where he's having a little bit of success until those weird elbows, and then he kind of falls out of the cage. They call it a knockout loss. He has beaten UFC level competition coming into the UFC. He beat Marcel Fortuna by knockout. Wild finish in that one. Andreas Michailidis, European BJJ champ, three-time kickboxing champion. Like, he has those things. It's just bringing them all together in an MMA cage. And for Michailidis, it was his last fight against KB Buller. And even the striking numbers, I went back, they might look close. Go back and watch the fight. Michailidis wins that fight every single minute of that fight. He's winning it on the feet. It's like, it's too simple. Like, KB's standing there with his hands like this, and Michailidis all day is hitting him right up the middle. So for Andreas, I just worry a little bit. His takedown defense isn't all that great. Is he going to have to worry about that in this fight? No, he's not. But his attempts to get takedowns aren't all that great either. It's the wrestling that really struggles to get into the grappling. So once he gets taken down, sometimes he can get back up to his feet. Sometimes he struggles. You look at the losses, they're all knockout losses. So I don't necessarily like that. But again, I look at the odds for this one. Pereira open a minus 150 favorite. He's minus 257 or thereabouts on best fight odds. For Michailidis, open a plus 130. He's a plus 203 right now. He has those abilities on the ground, and that's how this fight's going to be marketed. That's how I look at it. Michailidis can get a submission in this fight. I don't doubt it. I mean, Alex Pereira is going to have to do his damnedest to keep it on the feet, but every fight starts on the feet, Craig. So that's exactly where Pereira has that advantage. And again, he does stand very high with his hands up, MMA or in kickboxing, and his legs are totally exposed. So if you're a great wrestler, I mean, boom goes the dynamite. Now, I'm sure he's trained with the best in the world at Teixeira MMA and Fitness to negate some of those kind of attributes that fighters would have against him. I look at this one, though, again, I would be worried about putting a lot of money on a fighter that's 3-1 in MMA against a guy who's fought in MMA for a very long time. So yes, I understand Pereira, knockout win, unanimous decision win over Adesanya from years past. But again, when it comes to this fight, I haven't been that high on Andreas Michailidis in the UFC, which leads me to pick Pereira because, again, he has that touch of death type of power. But again, I would stay away from this. You work hard for your money, this wouldn't be the one I'd put it on.
I love the fact that he trains the Glover to Sharon. I'm really happy that you brought that point up multiple times, because I think that's going to be a massive key just to his overall progression throughout the UFC. Because if he can consistently stay training with Glover, who, yes, is a little bit older, but you have to think, MMA knowledge-wise, like, Glover Teixeira has forgot more than any of us will probably ever know. And the thing about that matchup, too, is Glover's going to be able to work with you on all the things you don't do well, because he is so well-rounded himself. He is a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He does have phenomenal MMA wrestling. Those are all things that he's going to be able to work with Pereira with. And they're the same size. That really does matter. If there was a massive size discrepancy between the two, then they wouldn't be able to have a lot of that one-on-one training. But the fact that they are those primary training partners is a very big deal.
Something that also scares me about this fight, for Alex Pereira, he's had two kickboxing fights this year in 2021. He won the first one by split decision. They rematched. He lost by split decision. And that wasn't all that long ago. The point I want to make, those fights were at light heavyweight in kickboxing, and I wrote it down here somewhere in my notes that that's at 209 pounds, if I'm not mistaken. And in the first fight, Todd Grisham, get out of there, Travis, and Bazooka Joe say, hey, why doesn't Pereira move up to heavyweight? Because he has the frame. I mean, look,
he's
at
huge.
It. He's 6'4". He's got a giant reach advantage over a lot of people. I do also worry a little bit about the weight in this fight, seeing how he has such a giant frame. And Mihailidis is kind of almost purpose-built for 185, too. So, yeah, I'm worried about that.
No, I agree. And it is kind of surprising. If Pereira did fight at 205, A, guys up there are a lot less well-rounded in the majority. Like, the 205-pound division, let's just be honest, there's a lot of primary strikers, primary grapplers, not a lot of super well-rounded guys, as opposed to middleweight, where you've got guys like Marvin Vettori, Robert Whittaker, Calvin Gastelum, like, guys who can mix everything and do everything. So, for Pereira, a path to the title might be easier at 205 pounds, actually, when you really think about it. But I do think the UFC wants him at middleweight just so they can try to build up that storyline of him versus Adesanya. I think that's a great point, though, bring up the weight. Maybe that could be a talking point by question mark kicks. But here today, I do like Alex Pereira in this fight.
Both of us going with Brazil's Alex Pereira with the Glover to share a connection to get the win. You let us know who you have down below in that comment section. I want to hear from you. Do we do a good job? Do you have Mihailidis? Do you have Pereira? Did you have Glover to share last weekend? This should be an absolute barn burner of a fight. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Attention listeners across the galaxy, all the way from Australia to Houston, do we have a pube problem? You know it! You know it! Let's go! Hey, if so, our friends at Manscaped, they have cleared you for takeoff with their fourth generation and brand new Lawnmower 4.0. Kick your pubes to the next planet with the Performance Package 4.0. The orbits in your pants will feel like you're in zero gravity when you use the best tools for the job from the leaders in male grooming. Join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped and get your rocket ready for takeoff by going to manscaped.com for 20% off and free shipping with code FNP. Now, Matt, we've talked about the product time and again. We have been long-time users, listeners, and talkers of Manscaped. You know where to find them. You know the promo code's FNP. So what can I tell you about them? Well, today I woke up. We're filming this on Monday. And I decided I need a little bit of a pick-me-up. I need a little bit of a spritz. I checked out the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. I spritzed a little bit on. Now, for me, did I go with those Manscaped boxers? You know I did. And if you throw in the Crop Reviver that I dropped on the floor, you know that you're going to have a good time. It ended up being quite a nice day. They also have in the performance package the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. And if it's really been a rough go and you really need a big pick-me-up, pop the cap, put a little bit of that salve on there. You're just going to slap it on there and it's going to work the very best for you. But I mean, realistically, you know, you want an out-of-world experience, it's very, very likely that you're going to want that Lawnmower 4.0. Now, right now, I have it on. It's working like it should. You got the LED at the bottom. You have a 4000K LED light up the top. So if you have a shower, if you have a corner of a room, maybe you live under the stairs, you're going to want this so you can see what exactly you're doing when you're doing the work that you don't want anybody else to see, unless you do, but I don't. So the nice thing about this is, and it's something that I traveled with last week when I was away, the travel lock. 1, 2, 3, LEDs are going up. Hit it again. Well, look at that. They're off. 1, 2, 3, they're going down. And then there you go. We're back in business. So I don't have to worry about the whole charging aspect and losing my battery life with something buzzing in my suitcase. when I don't mean to use it. The other nice thing about it is I can pop the top off. I can clean whatever is in there. At the same time, I can grease that motor, get it moving, get it shaking. And then the best part about the entire thing for me, and I can only speak from my personal experience, and I know darn well I need to use this, the weed whacker, the nose and ear hair trimmer. You've heard it before.
Ooh.
Yeah, see, normally I go with one side, but they're pretty bad, and after the show, I'm going to be fixing it. So, make sure you check them out. It's manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping with that code FNP at manscaped.com. Your dick and balls need some help. A clean Trinity and beyond. Your space balls will thank you. So, check them out. And listen, ultimately, listen, I've had a really, really good time with them. You know, they've been along for the ride for a number of months now. And ultimately, I really do like the products.
Yeah, no, they've been great. We've been using them for a while, like you said. And like this whole thing started off, do you have a puke problem? No, because you've been using Manscaped for so long. And they do work really nice. I do like that it's really good for the shower because you don't have a great light in there. So it really lights the way, helps you out a little bit. And yeah, use promo code FNP for 20% off.
Make sure you check them out. We have some big fights coming up on this main card. Two title fights. Gaethje taking on Chandler. You're not going to want to miss any of it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight. Coming up this weekend, we have one of the best lightweights of all time in New Jersey's own, Tom's River's own, Frankie Edgar. The answer, some would say. The answer to the question why could be Chito Marlon Vera. And Matt, this is a fight where I was getting ready for it. I was on my phone on the weekend. And if anybody didn't know, we're brothers. I mean, there's all, every single week, people just don't even realize
really?
That. I don't know how. We have the same last name. We look the same. We talk the same. We talk about MMA. But still, I'm sitting there texting our dad. And I was like, yep, big card this weekend. But hey, wait, there's more. There's pay-per-view coming up this week. And I texted him and I went, Frankie Edgar's 40. Like, how crazy is that? I remember getting excited for Frankie Edgar fights years ago, and for people that you guys must be like the Conor McGregor era.
No.
No, we're not. We're like the Frankie
the
Edgar.
The Shogun Hua Machida era.
The Ota Machida era. That's when we were in MMA at the beginning. So, for me, Frankie Edgar, the name holds a lot of weight. The last five fights have been impressive and not so impressive. He beats Cub Swanson in his fifth to last fight almost 4 years ago. Did I mispronounce last? That's how incensed I am by Frankie Edgar fighting. Loses to Max Holloway. Loses to Korean Zombie. But that one, eh. Beats Pedro Munhoz. But did he really? And then his last time out, loses in impressive fashion to Corey Sandhagen. For Marlon Vera, not even his last five fights. His whole UFC run has been hot and cold like the Katy Perry song. He beats Andre Ewell by knockout. He loses to Song Yadong. He beats Sean O'Malley by finish. He loses to Jose Aldo and it didn't look all that great. And then he beats Davey still in the Navy rematch and Grant. And he looked pretty good in his last fight. So ultimately, here's the key to this fight. Is Frankie Edgar durable anymore? Because I know he's still a good wrestler. And I know out of that fight against Pedro Munhoz that he can still fight with a high rate. Good volume too. I thought I thought Pedro won that fight 3-2. But regardless, a competitive fight.
And one of the best fights of the year.
Yeah, a competitive fight and a great one. And for Chito Vera, I know his takedown defense isn't all that great. Sometimes he can get caught in a mirror, but on his best day, he looks really, really good. Like, Davy Grant's old, sure.
So's Frankie Edgar.
And in that fight, Marlon brought his whole arsenal and bag of tricks together. So, for me, honest to goodness, with the bias and the when I get into fighting and just everything that's happened recently for both these guys, I honestly have to say, I have a hard time picking this fight.
It is a really difficult fight to break down because this is going to be one of those one-way traffic type of matchups. Either Frankie Edgar goes 9 of 11 on his takedown attempts.
Yair Rodriguez.
Exactly. Compiles a ton of ground and pound. Maybe even gets a submission just because he puts such a pace on Marlon Vera, because that's the thing people forget about with Frankie Edgar. He's a legit submission threat in a lot of his fights. And I don't think that's something that's talked about. People like his pace. They know how good his chin was. I guess we'll get to that in a second. But there is a lot to like still about Frankie Edgar. It does come down to how durable is Edgar. And it's been weird because he ate a lot of big power shots in that Pedro Munhoz fight. We all know how heavy-handed a guy like Munhoz is. And Edgar was still able to get through a grueling five-round war with him. But his next time out, the first clean shot that lands, he does go down. So it really is an interesting question. And no pun intended because his nickname's The Answer. I feel like this is Marlon Vera's last chance though at the elite. And I guess I'll kind of give it back to you on this because His first big opportunity at the top 15 was John Lineker. A lot of people forget that he did fight John Lineker back in the day when John Lineker was still a very well-known top contender. So he loses to John Lineker, no big deal. You then go down and fight Douglas Silva de Andrade. He then loses that one, and then he kind of gets put to the back of the line in the contender status, goes on a great win streak. Everybody kind of knows him as being that exciting fighter. He's able to work his way up back into the rankings, has the controversial loss to Song Yadong. I know a lot of people who thought Marlon Vera won that fight. It was very close, but you can see the trend here. He's fought Song Yadong, a top 15 guy, and he loses. He fights Jose Aldo, a top 5 guy, loses to him. And John Lineker at the time was at a minimum a top 10 talent, and on his best day was the top 5 guy. Just, it really feels like to me, if Marlon Vera can't get past Frankie Edgar, then he's just going to be stuck in that like 11 to 20 range where he can have a fun fight with anybody, but he can also lose to anybody. Now, if he goes out there, lands a knee up the middle on Edgar, sends Edgar really across the cage, he's able to land a really nice combination and maybe put him away, then maybe we'll see him finally break through and become that contender. But this is such an important fight for Chito Vera.
Well, and this is the thing, and we talk about it every single week now. So let's go back to last weekend. Islam Makhachev fights Dan Hooker. Dan Hooker's got those long-range weapons. He's got decent jiu-jitsu. Oh, and by the way, when people are coming in on him, great knees, great elbows. What happens? Makhachev takes him down, submits him. One of the most impressive, like, grabs his arm. Oh, we're in a Kimura. Oh, well, that's over. You could see that. And then hopefully for Danny's all right, because I kind of heard after the fact that Islam was, like, cranking on it, but the referee didn't do anything, so he didn't know what to do. So hopefully Dan's arm's all right. In this fight, I think Frankie Edgar can get the takedown, like, 10 times out of 10. When you have elite wrestling like that against a guy like Marlon Vera, you're going to be able to get the takedown easily. Can Marlon Vera hit him before he comes in for it? Can he keep the fight standing? And can he threaten with jiu-jitsu when it's on the mat? Those are the things that I'm not so sure of. Also, again, Frankie Edgar's chin's been checked multiple times lately, so we'll have to see how that holds up too.
And that's why it's such a volatile matchup. Like, the ways that we've laid this out are Frankie Edgar wins a 30-25, or Marlon Vera gets like a crazy posterization knockout, and we all go crazy and we think he's a top 10 fighter. And that's really the only way this fight goes. Now, the more we've talked about it, of course, Frankie Edgar should win this fight up until any major action does happen. And I know I've been really caught up in this point, but we see this a lot in fights where one guy's just winning sort of the in-betweens. He's winning the range fight. He's winning just being a more active guy. But then he gets caught by something big. And Marlon Vera has that ability, but I'm going to go back to my point about the Nassourdine Imavov and Edmund Shabazian fight. Imavov doesn't have, like, this crazy, crazy level of output, and he doesn't have this crazy, crazy knockout ability. I kind of put Marlon Vera in that same category, where he can put you down if he lands a clean shot, and he doesn't have bad output by any means, but he really needs both of those things to be really successful in an MMA fight. And I don't know if he's going to be able to win that output battle against a guy like Frankie Edgar, because unless you do hit Edgar with something hard enough to really hurt him, he's going to be in your face all day long. He's going to be threatening with takedown attempts. And he does have that Clay Guida X factor where it's, hey, no matter what we're doing, I'm doing something. So I know Edgar's 40 years old. I know that's not a good age at bantamweight, but I do kind of like him in this fight.
He just turned 40 3 weeks ago. He's a man.
He is.
He's 40. Mike Gundy, Matt, in terms of the total votes on Tapology, 1,200 of them, 68% with Vera, 59% by decision, 31% by knockout for the 32% that have Edgar, 87% by decision. I'm halfway surprised that that many people have Marlon Vera to win. I'm very surprised that the majority have him to win by decision. That's not that easy.
Like, he was losing a decision to Brad Pickett before he knocked him out. You have to remember that. That didn't even happen. That was UFC London, Jimmy Manuel versus Corey Anderson. So it was a little while ago, but still.
Levels to this.
You get the idea, though. Like, Brad Pickett in his retirement fight. And I've got nothing but respect for Brad Pickett, but still. He was pretty far over the hill by the time it was all said and done. He was putting up a really good performance against Marlon Vera until he did eat a head kick. So I just, it's hard to rely on Marlon to really put out a crazy output and beat anybody based on numbers and volume.
Really, if I go look at Queen News of the World, you know what, as the episode that, Family Guy had a lot of fun with, Matt got the record because I liked it. For me, for Christmas, that sentence didn't make any sense, but there's one song that's on this record that does, Fight From the Inside. That's actually a real
song. That's what Frankie has to do.
That's what Frankie's got to do, Matt. News of the world. You got to fight from the inside. I think Frankie Edgar's going to be able to get it done with that wrestling X factor. The fun fight is going to be when Marlon Vera, if and when he wins by finish, but I like Edgar. Due to the activity that he has once he's inside that cage and the wrestling, can Vera knock him out? If it happens, you're going to love it. It's going to be like when Makwan Amirkani got finished by Lerone Murphy. And it could be a first round like that. And then the second round, you know, insert Marlon in place of Lerone. And there we go. It's over. For me, I actually like the underdog in this one. I'm going with Frankie Edgar.
I agree.
Matt, both of us going with Frankie Edgar to get the win in 2021. At 40 years old against a guy that can finish. Yes,
yikes.
We are. You let us know down below in the comments section. Who's getting the win? Marlon Vera is a minus 168 average favorite. Frankie Edgar plus 139. We've got Edgar. Are we crazy? Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Absolute banger. Coming up this weekend at Featherweight, we have two guys that do not know quit until their bodies quit. That's pretty much it. Shane Burgos is taking on Billy Quarantillo. And Matt, let this be said right now. All I want for Christmas is a Blake Griffin dunk. Well, we got Blake Griffin dunked on by Billy Quarantillo in his Instagram story after his last fight against one great, great striker, Mr. Gabriel Benitez. And we said Gabriel's going to win that fight. His leg kicks, his body kicks, they're all the difference. And Billy Q's cardio didn't look all that great against Gavin Tucker. Well, again, we get dumped on all over the internet. Everybody made fun of us. And so what? Who cares? We have fun. We move on. We're in the good graces of Billy Q. I had a great conversation with him after the fact. And he said, yeah, in the Tucker fight, a body kick made the difference. That's what led to the cardio issues in the fight. And then since then, all he did was core and ab workouts, and that's why it went on. And Billy has been a cardio king, except for in that one fight. So don't let that one outlier define the man and his whole career. 100%. All right, let me say some nice things about Billy. He's got great cardio. To get into the UFC or even on Contender Series, he beat, and this is going to sound crazy, from the Gary Roberts Performance Center, one Adrian Veleka, a guy who was on our show before that fight, which is kind of crazy, and trained with Anthony Romero for the longest time, who will end up in the UFC, but he got the win over the guy that trains Connor McDavid, so that's pretty cool. And realistically, Billy and the UFCs look good, except for that one fight. He outlasted Spike Carlisle, who's doing it on the regional scene. He knocked out Kyle Nelson, Canadian. He loses to Gavin Tucker, Canadian. And then he beats Gabriel Benitez and looks amazing. For Shane Burgos, Hurricane Shane, the last two losses. Giant puncher Josh Emmett, who's coming back with a vengeance. Giant puncher Edson Barboza. But before that, the wins over Kurt Hollibaugh, Cub Swanson. And Matt, I'm too excited about this
you
fight.
You are.
Makwan Amirkani. So I love this one because for Burgos, we don't often see Tiger Schulman strikers. And when we do, it's Jimmy Rivera, Shane Burgos, and oh, by the way, Julio Arce. And I love what they do.
Cardio is going to be such a big factor in this fight. That's really all I can think about right now. Because Shane Burgos and Billy Q are two guys who not only have good cardio, they fight with absurdly high outputs. And that really is a big point. I remember you gave me a really hard time saying Costa didn't have good cardio. But some guys who just fight with a crazy output are able to sustain that for a really long time. And even though Burgos is a guy who might throw hundreds of punches every round, quite literally, he's not a guy who I really worry about in the third round of, oh, his output's going to fall off a cliff, and that's how Billy Q is going to find his way back into this fight. Because for Quarantillo, that's sort of his window to get back into a lot of fights. And I don't mean this to be disrespectful. This is a huge compliment. Normally, he's not the most technical guy in his fights. Normally, he's fighting a guy who just their strikes might be a little bit more technical. They might be faster. They might have more knockout power. But he's such a well-rounded MMA fighter and somebody who does have that grit and grind sort of a style. And the thing I really like about Billy Q is that he does put a pressure on guys to where it's going to really sap their gas tank. And body shots are going to be a really big key to this fight. I'm glad you brought that up about Gavin Tucker and Billy Q, because Tucker's not the only guy who throws a lot of body shots in this division. Shane Burgos is somebody who likes to start his boxing combinations by starting with hooks to the body and then going back up to the top. And I think that's going to be a really big key to this fight, because let's say both guys do have very similar cardio, very similar outputs in their UFC tenures and careers up until this point. If Burgos is the one going to the body a lot more in this fight, especially early on, I do think that's going to bring Quarantillo back down to a more human level, especially with his own output. And that's where we can see Burgos really start to pull apart, because the only guys we've seen Burgos struggle with in the UFC are guys who can hit him harder than he can hit them. I don't think Billy Q has the power edge in this matchup. The only two guys we've ever seen who hit harder than Shane Burgos are, like you mentioned, Josh Emmett, who might be the heaviest handed guy in the whole division, and Edson Barboza, who, yeah, got knocked out by Giga Chikadze in his last matchup, but like, I wouldn't want to get hit by him. He hits pretty hard. So I just think Shane Burgos struggles against guys who are slightly better versions of himself, if that makes any sense. Guys who can hit him harder than he can hit them. With Billy Q, I think he can have the lasting power to make this a really interesting fight and at least get this into deep water so that we're going to learn more about the overall game of Shane Burgos. I just think Burgos is a slightly more refined version of Billy Q in a lot of aspects of his game.
Billy fights a lot like Josh Emmett, though, and that's the thing. Like,
he doesn't have the power of him, though.
Josh Emmett? He doesn't have the power of Josh Emmett, but he has a lot of those same qualities, and if he's able to up the volume, then all of a sudden you're in a zone, hitting his Q zone. Moon River Rock. Moon River Roll! I look at this one, he's got a great opportunity. So, Matt, I had a look at the odds while writing them down after I did all the tape study, as I do, and Burgos open a -170 favorite. He's a -201 best fight odds. Billy Q open +145, +164 right now. Over on Tapology, the over-under. I'm going to give you an over-under. I'm going to guess 55% Burgos.
Way above.
You think way above? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I guess. 1,143 total votes, 76% Burgos, 67% having to win by decision, the 28% by knockout for the 24% that have Billy, 60% by decision, 23% by knockout. So, honest to goodness, I do have a little bit of a hard time here because for Burgos, as the fight goes longer, sometimes guys can have a little bit more success. Josh Emmett pouring it on as that fight went on. But man, Shane was in that. That was a really good fight. That was a contender, actually, for fight of the year that nobody talks about. It was like that dark horse of the year. It's a lot of fun if you want to go back and watch it. I just watched it.
I don't think Billy Q has anywhere as close to the power Josh Emmett has in his hands. I really don't.
I didn't say that.
No. It's just like that's the big key for this fight. Burgos is struggling against guys who are more heavy-handed than he is. Josh Emmett has some of the craziest power we've ever seen for a guy his height. And the reason he won that fight was he put a lot of damage on Burgos late and he used his power to win. How did Edson Barboza win? Was able to land power shots late. Well, Billy Q doesn't really have that kind of natural power late.
But he's always there late.
But the big difference is he doesn't land power shots late into the third round like those other two guys do. Edson Barboza has a whole career of knocking guys out in the third round by output and by power. Look what he did to a guy like Dan Hooker, who is absurdly durable. It's just, I think Billy Q can last until the third round. I just don't think he has the skills to thrive in that third round like those previous three opponents did.
I've seen him do it time and time again, though I have a hard time picking him in this fight. I like Shane Burgos. Again, you talk about technical boxing, work on the outside and throwing shots to the body, ripping there. Obviously, you saw Sandhagen try it. Didn't work for him. Then what did Piotr Jan do? Started ripping to the body and started throwing some really good kicks. Shane Burgos is cut from that same Jimmy Rivera, Julio Arce cloth, where they do fight very similar. Now, again, does everybody from the same gym fight the same? No. The James Sim? I don't know. What am I saying?
I mean, like, Rivera wrestles a lot more than Burgos, and Burgos is much more boxing-oriented. But the one thing I will say about Shane Burgos, go back to the Kurt Holloway fight. Now, that's a weird fight because he gets dropped with the first strike that hits him, which isn't a good sign if you're a Shane Burgos believer. But he shows a decent submission game off of his back, and that's why that performance is kind of important. Like, he is able to get the armbar off his back, which isn't something we often see in MMA. Like, getting a submission off your back is really, really hard to do. But he gets dropped by a really early strike in it, so there's some pros and cons to the performance, that's all. I still like Shane Burgos.
I'm not throwing this one on any of my parlays. I like Burgos ever so slightly, but hey, Billy Q surprised me in the past. He surprised you as well. So both of us going with Shane Burgos to get the win. Let us know down below, Billy. We know you're watching. What you think of the video. And Matt, I think this is going to be a big time weekend. This fight's awesome. Make sure you check out Kicks 2 hours before the prelims for a final say on this, the others, and the two title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
I like the way you absolute banger on this card, on the main card. Justin Gaethje taking on Michael Chandler. A couple guys coming off of losses in their failed title bids against different opponents in the same division, in the same promotion. For Michael Chandler, multiple-time Bellator lightweight champion. And for both of these guys, there's so many different paths that crisscross over their careers because there was rumors that they might fight with Bellator. They both have fights against Eddie Alvarez, and they both know him very, very well. And his opinion on this fight definitely holds a lot of water. Check out what he had to say about this one on Twitter if you want some validity onto that one. But for Chandler, same thing happened for him that happened to Gaethje when they entered the UFC. Both burst on the scene with giant wins. For Gaethje, a fight of the year against Michael Johnson. For Chandler, a hugely quick knockout over Dan Hooker. And yeah, I know Hooker lost last weekend, whatever. But he is definitely a competitive fighter and a big-time matchup in this division. So then what does Chandler get? a path to the title against Charles Oliveira. Loses that fight, doesn't look all that great in it. For Gaethje, in his last fight, loses against Khabib Nurmagomedov. Like, stuff like that's going to happen. So I look at this fight, Matt. If you don't like sports, then I don't know who you are. And realistically, you know, what do you think about Huey Lewis in the news? I don't know where this is going. They're all right? No, they're okay. And you know what? Their early work was a little bit too new wave for me. But then in 1983, they came out with an album called Sports. And yeah, is that where my American Psycho references stop? It actually is. But when I look at this record, Matt, the heart of rock and roll is to beat them. And these guys have heart for days, and they're awesome strikers, and they're also guys that have wildly successful wrestling careers coming into MMA, and they use them primarily when they started. For Gaethje, slam knockouts for guys, or against guys. For Michael Chandler, he'd wrestle. What was his MMA debut in Strikeforce? He fought, you know, you want to talk music? He fought, you know, Creed Scott Stapp, but not that Scott Stapp, but that's not really a, you know, a common name. Regardless, these guys have that in their back pockets, but they're awesomely explosive strikers, and that's what makes this fight so much fun.
These guys are both two sides of the exact same coin, because like you had said, they're both extremely powerful punchers, they both have very nice striking games, but they use their wrestling in very different ways. With Justin Gaethje, he is from that Chuck Liddell mindset, where it's like, hey, I have my wrestling, but let's really use it as more of a defensive tactic than an offensive weapon. Whereas Michael Chandler is not afraid to go out there, shoot a double leg takedown, chain some single legs, and go for the submission win or try to grab and pound his opponent. I would say Chandler's the more well-rounded out of these two, although both share a very similar skill set. It's just the way that they use them is very different. I will say, though, Gaethje's wrestling might be somewhat overblown, and I do think that has to be said. This is something I'm very big on, where it's, yes, you have these great accolades outside of the cage, but when was the last time we saw you actually use them in an MMA scenario? We've never seen Justin Gaethje offensively wrestle in the UFC, and he's been in the UFC for a little while now. And even go back to when Poirier knocked him out. I'll never forget the call that Daniel Cormier had, where Poirier cracks him in the left straight, Gaethje's hurt, and Daniel Cormier says, and Justin Gaethje, the all-American wrestler, doesn't have the wherewithal to shoot for a takedown. Even Justin Gaethje, when he is rocked, when he is about to lose a fight, doesn't go back to what his natural instincts are. Even Conor McGregor talks about this, where when I hit wrestlers, they panic wrestle because that's their instinct. Justin Gaethje is so far removed from being that natural wrestler that even when he is hurt and goes back to his primary instincts, those instincts are no longer to try and wrestle my opponent. They're to respond with big power shots, which, yes, it gets him these crazy highlight reel wins, but I am concerned when he fights a guy like Michael Chandler, who, when he does decide to, could just shoot takedowns all day long.
Well, the craziest part about it is they talk in the UFC's countdown this week a bit about Chandler's wrestling, but a lot about Justin Gaethje's wrestling. He goes back to the University of Northern Colorado. They put him in their Hall of Fame. Then he goes to a football game, and it's like, hey, here's Justin Gaethje. And some people stand up and clap, and it's weird. It's just really weird. Because, again, when he was an amateur and then an early pro,
Throwing guys,
slam knockouts. It was like he was, I don't know, Gerald Harris,
Kurt
if
Angle.
You want to talk, or Kurt Angle. Well, really, the Kurt Angle out of this whole week is Colby Covington. But still, when you focus on just this fight, there's so much fun. Because for Chandler, he fights and punches until he gets knocked out. For Justin Gaethje, he does more of the same. I mean, for Chandler, it's not that long ago where he got knocked out by Patricio Pitbull, a guy that I thought wasn't going to lose till the end of time, until he did. And then for Michael Chandler, like, it's just crazy. His last time out against Charles Oliveira, where, I mean, he gets himself into some bad spots. And he gets finished in that one, too. So I love this fight because, listen, it really is kill or be killed. The question I actually have for you before we move on, are you surprised that they didn't make this one a 5-round featured fight like they did Diaz and Lawler?
I'm not surprised. Now, listen, did the fan in me want to see this fight for 5 rounds? Of course. I don't know anybody who wouldn't want to see Michael Chandler fight Justin Gaethje for 25 minutes. Now, the good news is, I don't really think the time limit's going to matter because we're probably going to get a finish in this matchup no matter what. But just the fact that neither guy seems to be that A-tier superstar in the UFC is probably the reason why they're not doing the 5 rounds.
I think they are A-tier superstars.
I think they're slightly below that, personally, because for me, I really think the only A-tier superstars in the UFC right now are like Conor McGregor, Nate Diaz, maybe Jorge Masvidal, and that's it. Justin Gaethje hasn't fought in over a year, so I don't really think he has the star potential that he once did, and Michael Chandler is coming off a loss in a title fight. I do think both guys' star has somewhat been diminished since then.
I don't agree with you at all. So
that's
Matt,
fine, but it's two guys coming off of losses, so I don't really think either guy deserves a five-round slot.
Piotr Jan came off a loss fighting Corey Sandhagen.
He was in a title fight where everybody thought he was going to win, and the other guy won, or the other guy was in there because of injury. You know exactly why those guys got title shots.
Justin Gaethje.
And it was for a title. This isn't.
Justin Gaethje opened a minus 140 underdog. He's minus 198 right now. For Michael Chandler, open a plus 120. He's now a plus 162. The other thing to note, this is the beginning of the Whitman zone. This is three straight fighters out of Elevation Fight Team. You have Gaethje in the red corner, presumably. You have Rose Namajunas, the champion. You have Kamaru Usman, the champion. It's not often that you see that out of a very, very small cluster of fighters. I love to see that. Again, I think this is going to be a great fight. It's going to come down to chins. Maybe wrestling. It's really hard to tell, but both guys, when they sling leather, that's when it's the most fun. That's why I like this one.
So the way I look at this fight is, Justin Gaethje has the one-punch capability to knock out Michael Chandler. That's not a hot take. Everybody knows that. We've been saying this for a long time, though. I remember doing the fight companion for Charles Oliveira and Michael Chandler, and people came after Craig and I in the chat because Oliveira gets dropped in the first round, and that's what we have to say right now. Michael Chandler didn't look bad in that fight at all. He probably 10-8 at Charles Oliveira in the first round, then he gets knocked out in the first exchange in the second round. But Michael Chandler's looking really good. He gets hit by a shot, and I remember clear as day saying, right when he gets hit by that first shot, which hurts him, I go, oh, it's over. Because Michael Chandler does not recover well from getting dropped at all. He's somebody where it's one of those, like, bend, never break. Once his chin goes, he has a really hard time recovering in fights. And I think that's going to be a really big issue against Gaethje. Now, the flip side is that I think Michael Chandler only needs one takedown on Justin Gaethje to submit him. I really do think this is one of those, like, if Chandler gets one takedown, it's over. And if Michael Chandler lands one big power shot, it's over. I really do see this fight as cut and dry as that.
The only thing for me, and again, it's a fight that I went back and watched before the last Bellator event, and then I watched it getting ready for this one. It's a fight against Brent Primus. And in that fight, you know, was there a clash of heads? Was there a strike? Whatever. In that fight, Chandler gets rocked, and then Primus has a great opportunity to finish him. But what happens after that moment? Because that's early on in the fight. What happens after that?
23 minutes of ground and pound?
23 minutes of Michael Chandler out-wrestling and out-grappling one of the best grapplers at lightweight. And listen, you might go, oh, Craig, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're saying. Brent Primus has an Omoplata win not that long ago and just out-grappled Benson Henderson at 155. So just, again, Benson Henderson,
he's a little old, to be fair.
But he's a really good grappler when it's cut and dry. And Brent Primus is a guy that seems to think that he could out-grapple anybody at 155, and I'd be there for it. I'd be watching it. Let's just say that. Chandler's got a great opportunity in this fight. He's the underdog. Gaethje's got a good opportunity, too. He's a favorite. Let's look at the Tapology votes. Over under 65% Gaethje.
I think it'll be under. I think this will be very close. Wow.
1,294 total votes, 78% Gaethje, 86% by knockout. For the 22% that have Chandler, 58% by knockout. These guys have had knock 'em out, drag 'em out fights. Chandler versus Alvarez, Gaethje versus Alvarez. I like the Luis Palomino fights if we want to talk knock 'em out, drag 'em out fights that go on for longer than you think they would. So I love this fight. If we're making a pick, I really do have a hard time. I'm going to go to it, but what's your thoughts here?
So 9 times out of 10, I try to pick the more well-rounded fighter. The fighter who has more ways to win the fight, the one who can decide which range the fight's going to be fought at, and which stage the fight's going to be fought at, whether that be in the clinch, on the feet, or on the mat. Now, if I follow those principles, I should be picking Michael Chandler right now, but my issue is his durability. I really worry about his ability to eat power punches at really any weight division. Even Goichi Yamauchi, who is not a great striker by any means, was able to rock Michael Chandler with a nice hook kick in their fight. And Goichi's like a good fighter, but he's a phenomenal grappler. That's really what he's known for. And yes, he's got tricky karate, but if he's able to hurt you on the feet, if Justin Gaethje lands one clean shot, it's going to put you out. And I really do think Gaethje has that kind of power where if he only lands one punch, he's going to put you down. And this is the last thing I'll say. Khabib Nurmagomedov said Justin Gaethje's the hardest puncher he's ever fought. And Gaethje only landed like two clean shots in that fight. He lands a few nice leg kicks and a nice looping left hook. If you can at least get Khabib to admit that you somewhat hurt him in a fight, I think that's more than enough to put Michael Chandler down. Now, I openly admit it, if Chandler gets a takedown, I think he is the superior grappler, but I think Gaethje can at least defend one, maybe two takedowns and force this fight to be contested on the feet.
I think Gaethje wins this fight, but Goaty, if you're out there, you're a really good striker. And again,
really good.
When I look at this one for Gaethje, again, those fights coming in, the 5-1 in, the James Vick knockout, the Edson Barboza knockout, two and a half years ago. Donald Cerrone, 2 years and a month ago. Tony Ferguson, a year and a half ago. Yeah, but you can pick apart both of them, and both of them, you know, they've been finished in the past, so it is what it is, but one guy a lot less so than the other one. I like Gaethje with the knockout ability, and I like it fairly early on, but if this fight goes into the second round, maybe you start to look at Chandler, especially depending on how that first round went. So I'm going to go with the favorite here. Again, I like Gaethje in this one because I think he has a better ability to eat a shot. Chandler hits awfully hard as well.
And that's the thing that should be said. It's not like Michael Chandler can't win this by knockout just because Gaethje has a good chin and Chandler has been knocked out in the past. Like, Gaethje's been hurt, but the difference is they've been massive shots that have hurt Justin Gaethje. Like, think about the knee up the middle that Eddie Alvarez hit him with. That was one of the greatest fights of all time that got ended by one of those vicious strikes of all time. Think about the left straight Poirier landed on him. He checks a kick, steps into a left straight, and he's one of the most vicious punchers in the division. Then look at Michael Chandler. He's been clipped by shots and gone down in the past by them. It's not always the case of him getting hit by the most solid shot in the world. So no, I agree. I do like Gaethje.
Both of us going with the Northern Colorado Wrestling of Justin Gaethje to get the win. Two big time rematches and title fights up top. Trevor Whitman coaching half of those fighters as well. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at 115 pounds. We have a rematch for both of these fighters. Rose Namajunas taking on Zhang Weili. The title switch hands the last time they fought, and it was kind of surprising that their paths didn't cross a little bit earlier. But I absolutely love the fact that we're going to get this fight. Now, Rose Namajunas might not absolutely love it because she was able to get a giant flash knockout win. The post-fight was very emotional. The build-up to their fight was wildly aggressive. And now we're here where we have Zhang Weili, who's changed up everything with her camp, now training at a fight-ready MMA. I think that's a great move for her because Santino DeFranco, Eddie Cha, and then Zhang Weili's own coaches being there, I think that's an awesome move for her.
It's an interesting move. I always have some hesitations when you have a really high-profile fighter making a wholesale change to their gym and just really training regimen as a whole. And yes, you're right. She still has a lot of her original coaches. But think about Sergey Kovalev. He's one of your favorite boxers of all time. Sergey Kovalev had his original Russian trainers, went to America, started a new camp, and then all of a sudden he had 9 different voices in his corner, and nobody really knew exactly what or who took precedent or who was really the head coach. Like, this can go a lot of different ways. So it will just be really interesting to see how Weili looks in the opening minutes of this fight, because it's a very boxing thing to do. It's, I'm the champion, I lose, now let's make all these changes to my camp.
You could say it was like they were at a recycling plant and nobody knew what to do with the crusher. Now, in this fight, Magnum Zhang Weili, again, she's at fight ready, but the weirdest part about this is the fact that she's training with some former champions, Deiveson Figueiredo, but namely Henry Cejudo, who looks like he's the main ear and focus, not just on the countdown, but on the Instagrams. And the best part of the countdown is probably this. Why does Henry Cejudo have not just pillows of, like, his girlfriend, but also pillows of the schmo? When do we become pillows there?
How did we get a schmo pillow? No?
I don't know. There's a lot of really big questions coming out of that household, but it's interesting to see Cejudo because I think he's one of those guys, and we talked about it all the time. There's fighters that, should they hang him up earlier? Should they hang him up at all? Could they become very good coaches? Glover Teixeira didn't have to do any of that. Now look at where he's at. Great coach, great champ, old guy. He's 42. That's old enough for fighting. But still, it's interesting to see Cejudo there and the little wisdom nuggets that he's dropping along the way. I'm sure Figueiredo, you know, with the help of the translators that they have there between all of the different languages, they're really able to figure out a great game plan. And again, I really think that Santino DeFranco and Eddie Cha are very, very good coaches. So I'm interested to see that change. But from Namajunas, the other thing I have is, and they talk about it in that embedded, or the countdown rather. Okay, she's got her training camp at elevation. She's got Pat Barry. She's got Trevor Whitman. Say whatever you want to say about the former, less the latter. But the fact that she's trained a little bit in Minnesota to work her wrestling with Brock Lesnar's old coach, I found that one a little bit of a head scratch. I was kind of surprised by it more than anything.
Really? I mean, Brock Lesnar used to train at Elevation, though. He's got a good relationship with Pat Barry, their main training partners.
Where's Chris Tushisher fit into all of this?
It doesn't matter. I don't think that's that weird, her training with Lesnar. There's an obvious connection to the camp.
Not Lesnar. It was the coach. Lesnar's okay, still in close to Regina.
But still, though, the coach would be the connection. Like, Lesnar would be the connection to the camp. That, like, him and Barry were main training partners, but Lesnar was UFC champ.
It's just, it's very interesting to me. All of that to say, coming into this fight, Zhang Weili had a giant head of steam. I mean, she had only lost the one fight. It was, what, her pro debut? 21 straight. We look at the last five on in. Old Jag Aguilar, Tisha Torres, Jessica Andrade knockout win, Yoni and Jacek split decision win, where one of the best fights I've ever seen in my entire lifetime. For Rose, she beats Jan Jacek. She beats Jan Jacek. She loses to Andrade by slam. She beats Andrade by split. And then she beats Zhang Weili. So coming into this fight, I don't know if we can say all the same things we said before their first fight, but coming into this one, big changes from Zhang Weili. Not as big changes from Rose, but again, we're looking to improve in certain areas. I love the fight because you talk about what both these women are good at. Not necessarily the same things, really.
They're not, although they both are extremely well-rounded. They just kind of get it done in slightly different ways. And it is interesting. If you had told me before their first fight that Rose Namajunas had more power than Zhang Weili, I'd look at you sideways and think you're crazy. I wouldn't believe you at all. I understand Rose had knocked out Joanna, but still, Joanna had the weird weight cut. They had the rematch. That was a phenomenal fight. I just thought Zhang Weili would have been the much more powerful striker. But Rose showed that striking intelligence and timing just kind of beat pure athleticism, speed, and power. And that was the really impressive thing to see from Rose in their initial fight. It wasn't just the fact that she was able to land that head kick so early. It's the fact that she was able to set the head kick up so early. She knocked out Weili Zhang, what, slightly over a minute in their first fight? But she still was able to get enough work done to threaten with the low kick enough to then open up that high kick. That shows striking IQ that is really unheard of in multiple divisions, and something that really only a guy like Trevor Whitman can unlock within a lot of athletes. And that's why I almost like Rose Namajunas staying with her own gym more than Weili going and trying to get more information. This is the thing. I like Weili Zhang going to a different gym and at least trying to learn new things, but we normally see it take 1, 2, 3 training camps for that knowledge to really go and impact that new fighter all of a sudden. It takes a little bit of time. That's why I'm a little bit worried. If Weili all of a sudden comes into this fight trying to add new things to her game and not just being that phenomenal outside striker who could mix in her volume, have really nice power punches up the middle, I think she's doing something wrong. I really don't think that it was a game plan issue. It was just Rose did something really well in their first fight. So if I'm Weili, I would have the exact same game plan. I might just try to be slightly more aggressive. The problem I have with picking Zhang in this fight is she lost in the striking, which was the area I thought she would have success in. We didn't even see any grappling between these two women, and Rose Namajunas might be the trickiest jiu-jitsu player in this division. Her grappling, to me, is almost like Aljamain Sterling's, and that's kind of the comp I want to use for Rose Namajunas. I know Rose might have more power than Aljo, which is weird, you wouldn't really think of that, but just think of the way they fight. Rose, an unorthodox striker from the outside, mixes in her volume, can fight from both stances, but her bread and butter is once she gets fighters to the ground, she's so tricky and she can overwhelm her opponent with multiple passing attempts, ground and pound threat, and then open submissions up. It's just, after seeing what we saw in the first fight, now I think Weili will struggle a little bit on the feet with Rose, which is something I didn't think was going to happen in the first fight. And I definitely think Rose is the better grappler out of these two. I don't know what area of Zhang's game she could massively improve upon, and then it would all of a sudden show in this fight.
I think you're going to see a more technical game plan out of her. Again, made a little bit of a mistake, has to make some adjustments here and there, and I think wrestling with somebody like Figueiredo, somebody like Cejudo, everybody that they have fight ready. Hell, throw Tracy Cortez in there.
It's tough to wrestle Rose, though.
Vanessa Demopoulos is there. You get to work a little bit of that ground game. But you look at this one, the odds, they are at par. Where do they open? At par. I mean, slight movement Weili's way, actually. She's a little bit more, like a minus 115 to minus 105 thereabouts. The votes on Tapology are going to be new to us. They're going to be new to you. So I'm going to guess 70% Rose Namajunas over under.
I was thinking 60-40 Rose, so I'll say under.
68% Namajunas out of 1,264 total votes, 61% by decision for the 32% that have Zhang Weili, 55% by decision, 35% by knockout. More actually have, so if I go back to that graphic, 24% have Namajunas to win by knockout to 35% that have Zhang Weili to win by knockout. That kind of surprises me based off of what we saw, but hey, people aren't taking recency bias into account. That's cool. That's all right.
My question for you, I guess, is since Weili is such a well-rounded MMA fighter, she's shown that in the past. I know she's a primary striker, but she's shown the ability to grapple and wrestle in the past. what would you recommend she does try to add to her skill set to beat someone like Rose? And I know that's a hard question to just answer, but you're fighting another person who is well-rounded, who has that similar game. It's just, what could Wei Li do so much different in this fight?
Wei Li, I know you're not listening, but if it was me, pitter-patter on the outside, kind of wear her down in the first and second rounds, and then turn it on rounds 3 and 4 and 5.
Fair enough.
That's it. But I don't think she's listening. It'd be like me talking to the wall.
We have fans who watch these, Craig. You're more talking to them to tell them about different areas both fighters can have success in.
That's what I would see. Like, if you wanted to see something improve from Zhang Wei Li, that's what I would suggest to her, because that's a question that you asked me. But realistically, in this one, having seen that Rose can stand and trade, and she did it with Joanna too, so you got to really consider that in two different fights. But if it ever goes to the mat, I don't want to see Zhang Wei Li coming into this fight really aggressive with the takedowns and whatnot. That's where you're going to get in trouble. And that's the gym that she went to kind of accentuate certain areas. I thought about this one. I've racked my brain about this all week trying to think about the pick. And maybe it'll change on Saturday. I'm a human being, so I might change my pick. But right now, I have Rose Namajunas in the rematch.
So do I. This is a really close fight. And if Wei Li was a much more aggressive version, if she was able to close the distance on Rose,
which we've seen before.
Exactly. Not let Rose get off with some of her kicks and long-range weapons, then I do think Wei Li has a path to victory. It's just, once you take into consideration the fact that we didn't even get to see these two grapple, and we know that Rose is one of the best jiu-jitsu players in the division, it's really hard to pick against Thug Rose.
In this fight, both of us going Thug Rose, Thug Rose, Thug Rose to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this fight. Absolute banger at 115 and another big-time fight in a rematch up at the top. 170 gold, Kamaru Usman. Looking like the best welterweight we've ever seen since, and maybe even better than George St. Pierre. Taking on a guy that talks to nerds and virgins a lot on the internet. And Colby Covington, big time fight that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time rematch in our main event of UFC 268. Kamaru Usman taking on Colby Covington for the second time. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, I'm going to put a challenge out there to the fans of Fight Night Picks. We get 1,000 likes for this video on question mark kicks. I'll do something crazy.
That could be anything.
1,000 likes for this video, something crazy. And listen, I'll even make it a better challenge. If you're watching the individual video, I'll add those likes to the main card video, and then it's going to be double the crazy. Now, I haven't said what I'm going to do. It could be anything. But what I do know is crazy, Colby Covington's taking on Kamaru Usman. That fight's going to be insane. What are you thinking?
I'm really excited for this matchup. But I hate to hand it back off to you so quick, but I had this planned out from the beginning. Do you feel like the hype's been around here for the rematch compared to the first fight? Because I don't feel like there's been that much hype surrounding this main event and this pay-per-view that much this weekend. Maybe that's just a byproduct because we're just coming off of another pay-per-view, a numbered event. But it just, to me, it doesn't seem like the hype's really there.
Well, and the weird thing about this one is the fact that Colby Covington's last win was just over a year ago. And for Kamaru Usman, his last win about 6 months ago when he knocked out Jorge Masvidal. And I gotta say, that's one of the most impressive knockouts I've ever seen in MMA, and I watch a lot of MMA, and that's insane. Why? Because everything I knew about Kamaru Usman, yeah, I had just seen the Gilbert Burns fight, and it was great, whatever. This guy's a wrestler, and when things get tough, he wrestles. What did he do in that fight? He beat Jorge Masvidal at the thing that he's good at and knocked him out cold.
And it was, like, extremely impressive.
And then he knocked out his friend Gilbert Burns before that, and then he, on technicality, TKO, but he finished Colby Covington. And were the broken jaw pictures a bad Photoshop, like Colby Covington's been saying? I don't know. But I do know that the finish is a TKO win on his record, and Covington's still talking about that, just like he talks to all you nerds and virgins out there on the internet. It's weird that every video he frames as a promo is to nerds and virgins. It's like he knows his target audience.
Like Alexander Volkanovsky famously said when he was on stage with Colby Covington, though, there's nothing wrong with being a nerd and a virgin. And it was pretty funny, because what are you going to do? Talk bad about Alexander Volkanovsky, one of the badder men of all time. This thing about Colby Covington, it feels like a lot of people, or at least from what I've heard, people just assume that he's made these massive gains since the first fight that he had with Kamaru Usman. And you can point somewhat to the Tyron Woodley matchup that he had shortly after their first fight, but the problem I have with putting a lot of stock into that is, are we giving Jake Paul the next UFC title shot? Because it is kind of funny that Colby Covington and Jake Paul do have the same last win.
The weirdest part about this whole thing is the fact that if you watch any of the promo or what I've seen lately, and I'm serious, I've watched some of it, you know, you might get a little tidbit of info here and there. Covington's performance against Woodley isn't accentuated at all, and that's really weird. Like, that was a good win. He looked amazing in that fight. Did Woodley look bad? A little bit's probably that, but Covington looked really good, so to his credit, that's a hugely important win over a guy. And Tyron Woodley, this is hard. This is like looking at BJ Penn today and going, that guy's running for governor? He was a bad UFC fighter. He's one of the best lightweights of all time. I mean, he won two belts before anybody else did it.
It was like me watching Derek Jeter the last, like, 5 years of his career, if we're all being really, really honest, okay? The first lot of them were amazing, and he was one of the best. But let's be honest, they kind of held on to him a little bit too long, and the glory wasn't really there the past few years.
Well, it's like with Tyron Woodley. At one point, this guy, when he's fighting Wonder Boy, when he's beating Darren Till, this guy's on his way to being the next GSP, and then all of a sudden, the bottom falls out. He fights over with Triller, and, you know, the rest is history. So we get a fight like this where both guys are good at the same things. Both guys can weaponize their cardio. They know that. I know that. You know that. We all know that. One guy fights at a pace where he normally turns it up. Oh, by the way, the other guy really does that. And if we're really, really, and again, you want to be honest with yourself, I was scoring that fight for Covington. I thought he was going to win it 3-2 before he got finished. So, hey, that is what it is. But since that time, one guy's had one fight, one guy's had two fights, and I've learned a lot more about one than I have the other. And all of a sudden, Kamaru Usman goes to Elevation Fight Team, turns up his striking, becomes a little bit more polished, unleashes his power, doesn't necessarily rely on his wrestling, and now into a fight like this, I don't expect either guy to wrestle. Their first fight was one of the best fights I've seen. Like, Usman Covington doesn't get the respect it deserves in that year. That's an amazing fight. And both of these guys are great. They're technical. And I think for Covington, he's talked about it since, the fact that I had to make the move from ATT. Again, I lost some friends. I lost some teammates. I lost this. I lost that. At the end of the day, he gets more personalized training. And we've seen that with certain fighters. It works out a lot better for them. Usman did the same thing and it worked out pretty good too. So
this is my question for you though. If you're a big star like Colby Covington, you probably do get personalized training in a place like American Top Team. I don't think Jorge Masvidal and Dustin Poirier just show up to ATT and train with everybody else.
That's it. Usman probably did at Sanford too, and still made the move.
But my point is with Covington, he went from American Top Team to MMA Masters. And it's nothing against MMA Masters, but it's not like he's going from Sanford MMA to Elevation, two of the top tier gyms in the world that have a plethora of training partners. Just with Covington, it does feel like he took a slight step back with his training. And it feels like a lot of that had to do with his public persona and him trying to keep this fight put together. I feel like his skill set might almost be hurt because he's so good at marketing himself. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but it is the truth. Like, Covington's admitted in the past that he's had weird relationships with a lot of the Brazilian fighters at American Top Team. And there's a lot of Brazilian fighters in American Top Team because of the way he's gone about his persona in the media. And I'm going to say this right now. I don't believe anything Colby Covington says when he puts on his whole shtick. Like,
oh, he did that interview with Candace Owens and said it was all a shtick.
Yeah, like, Colby Covington, if you've ever seen, like, fan videos and stuff, like, when people go up to him and kids and stuff, he seems like a perfectly nice guy. Like, this is all for him to sell fights, and it has worked out up until this point. But that's the problem. It feels like his persona and just the fact that he is so polarizing overshadows the fact that he is a very skilled martial artist. And the problem Colby Covington is going to run into in this fight, and just this matchup in general, is that in 99% of matchups, he's going to have the better cardio and he's going to be the better wrestler. And his output on the feet is going to be enough to just sort of fix the striking holes that he does have. Because Colby Covington is not a top-tier striker. He definitely has top-tier output, but he doesn't throw many kicks. His hands aren't all that refined. Like, there's a few things you can pick apart on the feet. Kamaru Usman does a lot of those same things. The difference is he's tightened his striking up a lot more and he has much more powerful strikes, so if he is able to land with similar volume, he just needs one of his shots to get through the guard of Covington, whereas Covington's going to need 5, 6, 7 punches to really hurt Usman. Now, I think Usman has a critical flaw in his game. I really do.
Bad knees.
No, he swings wild on the feet. Like, Jan Blachowicz, when he fought Glover Teixeira, right before it happened in our fight campaign, I said, he's going to get caught with a left hand. And not like he did get caught with a left hand right behind, because he was throwing that wild uppercut every single time he was backing up. Kamaru Usman, when he's pressured, does panic a little bit and start weighing power shots very often. Now, normally when guys pressure him, that's going to initiate a clinch situation. It's not going to be a big deal. Kamaru Usman's the superior wrestler. But I do think we've seen enough sample size to show that if Usman ever does fight one of those one-punch knockout guys, he leaves himself open enough that they're going to have a chance. Even look at Gilbert Burns. Gilbert Burns has good but not great power for the weight division. He was able to hurt Usman when he threw one of those wild looping shots. So I think Usman's not unbeatable. I do think there's a very specific fighter out there who might be able to put something together and hurt him. But I just think when he's fighting these other well-rounded fighters, he's always going to have the X factor of that unnatural cardio and just that crazy knockout ability.
The odds for this one, the champion is a big favorite. Open at minus 225. He's a minus 306 right now for Covington, the former interim champion. And then they took it from him. Plus 190 to a plus 242. Matt, the total votes for this one on Tapology, wow, not very close. 1,332 total votes, 82% Usman, 71% by knockout, 18% that have Covington, they're 67% by decision. And I mean, when I think about this fight, it really is a tricky one, because if you're Colby Covington, you've already been in this position before, you didn't come up on the winning end, and all he talks about is this fight. Like, yeah, he fought Tyron Woodley. Remember how they were supposed to fight time and time again? UFC 227, that was supposed to be the two of them. It ultimately did not end up happening. So then they got to go back. They got to make the fight again. And it's years down the road. Woodley really wasn't in a good spot at that point. And then we get the result that we get. But when I look at this one, I turn it on over to our community over on YouTube. You guys have the support. If you get over 1,000 likes, question mark kicks, I'm going to do something I don't often do. It's going to be a little bit of crazy, a double dose of crazy. I already said, so now I have to live up to my end of the bargain. It takes 1,000 likes. But the votes that we have over in the community tab for this main event, 69% have Usman to win, 31% have Covington. And over in that comment section, Bundle of Humble saying, last fight was close with a broken jaw early. If there's a person who can beat Usman on decision or finish, it's Colby.
Not
should
finish.
Should be a good fight or an upset. Fishburne is saying most of Colby's supporters are
sad to see, Chris.
Just get rid of that one. Let's go. Matt R is saying Twitter is going to melt if Colby somehow wins. NB saying Usman finishes, so on and so forth. Matt, there's got to be somebody out here that says something crazy. Jonathan Cesari is saying Usman, and it's not even close this time. Matt, I think I agree with Jonathan here.
It's just, okay, if they were, let's say they were power in their first fight, and Usman just had a minor edge, which was his punching power, and they were very similar, just the thing that separated them was the fact that when Usman lands clean, he can hurt you. I know for a fact Kamaru Usman has made massive improvements in his striking game. I can point to two separate championship-caliber fights in which he has made those improvements. With Colby Covington, I think he's probably improved his striking. I'm sure he's made massive improvements. But it's really hard for me to point to any of his past performances, or at least his one performance which separates the two Usman fights, and say, wow, against Woodley, his hands looked really good. Like, his wrestling looked good in that fight. But I really doubt he's going to be able to go out there and out-wrestle a guy like Usman. So I do like Usman in this rematch. And I will say this. This is the last thing. The fact that we can finally say Kamaru Usman might take GSP's spot as the best welterweight of all time really means a lot. We are two Canadians who grew up watching TV and watching GSP on every commercial just try to sell us Gatorade and Sport Check apparel. This is finally a fighter that we can look at and say, wow, he has that like Hall of Fame, Mount Rushmore, kind of goat ceiling almost. It's not something we often get to say.
Your number one pound for pound fighter right now is Kamaru Usman.
True.
As GSP's career went on, it was less finishing Pete Spratt and it was more decisions and then close decisions. For Usman, he just put the foot on the gas pedal and started to get finishes. So both of us are nerds and virgins in this case. My wife knows that I'm not one of those things, but I am more one than I am the other. Just banging like rabbits, maybe. Who knows,
what are
Matt?
You doing, Chris?
Absolutely love this fight. Both of us going with the Nigerian Nightmare, Kamaru Usman, to get the win. On question mark kicks, there might be a proper double dose of craziness.
I was going to say, and if you guys watched the last fight companion over the weekend, we did say that the next fight companion may have a certain after dark quality to it. So if you're looking to have a fun time and watch the fights, make sure you check out the question mark kicks, which starts 2 hours before the prelims. And if that gets you excited enough for the fights, and maybe, hey, you're sick and tired of listening to the usual Joe Rogan, Daniel Cormier, John Anik, you want to switch it up a little bit, you want to watch the fights with the boys, make sure you check out the fight companion, which normally starts, what, 5 minutes before the main card?
5 minutes before the main card. You get that bell notification going, you know exactly when we're going live.
I love this card and all of the content coming out this week with Fight Night Picks that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in, and as we always say, let's get into it.